Hello and welcome to another Crate and Crowbar Star Wars movie podcast breakdown Thurston sibling experience. My name is Chris Thurston and I am joined by Rebecca Thurston.
Hey!
Live from New York.
Hi, that's where I live.
Sort of. This is pre-recorded, but you get the reference. I was doing a reference.
I liked it. You were referencing Saturday Night Live.
I was, yes.
Yay!
Yes, good job. Me. So we did this back in December when you were in the UK.
I was.
And we went to see The Last Jedi, the most recent Star Wars film, and we recorded a podcast about it. And people seem to like it, so now we're doing this.
Hooray! Yeah, and this one's going to be a little different from last time, because last time was cooked up in a brew of sleep deprivation and jet lag and excitement.
Yeah.
And it was, we had been talking so much about the film that it felt like it made sense to record it. This time we're a couple of days afterwards. We've both seen the film twice. Solo, we should say. The film is called Solo, a Star Wars story.
Yeah, we should probably, it'll be in the title of the episode.
Yeah, it'll help. We'll figure it out. In an interesting departure from last time, we have not talked about what we think about the film.
No, this is, I mean, yeah, you know, a few small things, but we've basically avoided talking about it so we could do this. We also both saw the movie very recently in that I just got back from seeing it for the second time, and I believe you also just got back from seeing it
for
the second time.
I saw it this very morning, which in this country is also today.
That's time.
That's how that works.
I saw it this afternoon,
yes.
Which was at the same time as your morning.
It was.
Incredible. we've both seen it recently. So yeah, we're going to talk about Solo, a Star Wars story. And we are going to be talking about spoilers. We are going to talk about the entire plot of the movie and things about what done happen in it.
Things happen.
Indeed. So for that reason, if you haven't seen the film and you care about spoilers, then this is the time to stop listening and come back and listen after you've seen it. That's it. That's a spoiler warning. I have done my diligence.
Hooray.
It's going to have spoilers in it. This episode of the podcast, or our podcast. So, I know that we both want to talk about how Solo fits into Star Wars as a entity, both sort of culturally and industrially, but I also want to pin us down to actually talking about the movie Solo, the Ron Howard after Miller and Lord adventure film they actually made.
Yep.
So, Becky, what did you think of the film? Solo.
I had a rollicking good time in the film.
Mm.
Yep. And both times, I think my experience of it was, it definitely was, this is more of a, you know, life thing than a film thing, but it was very different not seeing a Star Wars without you. I realize it's the first time I've ever gone to a Star Wars, a new Star Wars movie without you.
We didn't see Rogue One together.
No, but I saw it the first time with you, because you'd seen it before me, but I waited until...
Right.
Yeah. So it was my first time going solo rodeo.
Indeed. And
I think a combination of that and the sort of what seemed to be a general kind of ambience of lowered expectations meant that it wasn't the same kind of like, I wasn't frightened in the same way. I got in like not really knowing what to expect, and I had a really good time at the movies. I mean, I'm sure there will be little things we'll pick it up on, but I really enjoyed it, I would say.
Right. Yeah, I did. I enjoyed it more the second time. I enjoyed it the first time.
Yeah.
I did. I think I came away from the first time. Like, also, I don't think I was in the right headspace for it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like Star Wars is like such a big part of my imaginative life.
Yeah.
It was weird for me to go to a Star Wars movie because it felt like the right time. Like, it's the first Star Wars movie I've not.
Yeah, midnight. Screening. Yeah.
Yeah, like day of release. I went on Friday night because it was sort of like the right moment to go and see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of unusual. Maybe that's used to lowered expectations. I think it's also, you know, we've entered I'm getting into the...
Yeah, this is what I want to talk about later.
Yeah, but like, you know, it's not the first standalone non-main series Star Wars movie ever. That was Rogue One.
Yeah.
I really like Rogue One. It's not... it's not the continuation of the story that everybody is waiting to see what happens next.
Yep.
So it has this sense of like, it's almost the first of the, like,
it's the first, it's a, yeah, it's funny.
Movies of the moment.
We said we'd save this for later, so I'll save it for later.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, that is the part of it that I have the most to sort of think about, I think. But, it's a very different way of, watching a Star Wars movie, and it does make you reevaluate what a Star Wars movie as like an event is, but yeah, we can get into that later.
I did really like it, and I think the second viewing, like, brought it to life for me. I think partly, like, I was more relaxed.
Yeah.
And it's a movie that suits sort of, like, I find most Star Wars movies for me do best on second viewing, but, like, it you know, it has a lot to kind of appreciate when you know what kind of movie it's going to be and where it's going mm-hmm. with all of those things. And I think the things that I like the most about it is it's a really, like, sort of lavish production design hung off a series of really good set pieces.
Yep.
With well-performed characters, basically, that bounce off each other in most of the time really cool ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so there isn't, I don't think, a scene in it that doesn't have something to sort of enjoy.
Yep.
Like, it stands out for me for it plays a lot of things quite safe, which is a topic we'll return to, I imagine. But, like, it's a rare example of a Star Wars movie, I think, where, like, I feel like every scene is sort of enjoyable either visually or in terms of the action or in terms of individual performance. I'd say none of the scenes and none of the kind of character moments get over a certain threshold into greatness.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah, I think that's
but
fair.
But it stays, but it's actually, I think, remarkably consistent yeah. as Star Wars movies go, which feels like damning with faint praise, but
I think,
like,
but there's yeah. a real pleasure to be had relaxing into that kind of movie with lowered kind of, I mean, I feel like I praise low stakes too much, and I don't want to make it sound like my ideal movie is a movie in which at the end two people have, like, a thumb wrestle. But, you know, there's an obvious, I think people are starting to get, it's been a few years now, but, a certain amount of end of the world fatigue. And I think, whether this is a blockbuster, I suppose, is another question, but I really enjoyed being in this world and having a kind of very, like, solidly handled summer blockbuster with, lowered but character-based stakes. That was really yeah. fun. Again, we're drifting into, like, industrial thing rather than Star Wars.
It's really hard to avoid with yeah. Star Wars, I think. So I, like, maybe to pin it to something, like, I think you're right. The thing that impressed me about Solo, and this is almost a political statement
yeah.
in the environment that it's been released into, and again, it's why it's almost impossible to avoid that surrounding conversation, but its world building is really nice and really consistent.
Yeah.
Like, I've been reading books and comics and things set on Corellia since I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, the young Han Solo novels were some of the first Star Wars novels I ever read.
Yeah.
And that vision of that world is different, mm-hmm. but it's so coherent. Like, that kind of, like, moody shipyard,
yeah.
rain-swept kind of slightly Blade Runner in some ways, like the towering arcology cities, but
yeah.
very Star Wars, very unlike the prequels in terms of its idea
Absolutely.
Of what a Star Wars metropolis looks
yeah.
like. But also very, very Star Wars, and packed with these little visual references to other material and sort of, and also to a kind of believable, but still sort of fantastical world. It was sort of like, it got so much right so quickly that, like, that initial kind of, after that sort of strange opening, not crawl, opening text, the blue text went rogue.
Which I like is, I mean, I know that they've played with this in, like, other Star Wars things outside the films, but, like, that in a way does capture a similar kind of relationship to, like, what size of story you're getting and what level of grandeur and what level of, like, players are involved. There's this, I mean, not to, like, over-egg the font pudding, but there's, like, a similar, like, level of, like, scale and the difference between, like, you need to know all of these things and it's the size of the sky to, like, there's a few kids and, you know, there's one kid who dreams or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like
there's, like, a lowered scale thing again that I like.
Mm. Like, Star Wars always begins with something big and industrial
yeah.
revving in your face, basically.
Yeah.
And in this, it's that speeder that Han is hot wearing.
Yeah.
I have to say, I didn't find the opening as impactful. Like, I really like Rogue One, so I'm going to set out my stall for
yeah.
Rogue One in some ways. But I really think the opening of Rogue One is clever at this, where
mm-hmm.
it has the Once Upon a Time in a Galaxy Far, Far Away, and
mm-hmm.
then there's a music sting.
Yeah.
And it's this gorgeous planet side, basically.
Yeah.
And it's very removed, and it's this small Imperial shuttle moving through a ring of a planet. And it's very much like, it's more of a statement of this isn't the Star Wars you know than Solo manages, I think, where it's sort of half a crawl, half not.
Yeah. I suppose it's also a difference of, with Rogue One, that's almost a kind of like, it's this isn't your daddy's Star Wars geographic orientation, where this isn't your daddy's Star Wars character, or like literally it's his hands as he's sparking the thing, right? And it's that, like, that few illuminations of the
yeah. and the kind of come on, come on, come on.
Yeah. And I really love the shift from that into that that huge view of Corellia as the title came up. I thought that I really liked that as a kind of setting out the size of this film. Where should we start with characters again? That's what we did last time.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. We should really start with Han Solo,
the
main character of the movie Solo.
Yeah.
I know Alden, is it Ehrenreich?
Ehrenreich.
I got a lot of flack initially that I thought was undeserved.
Yeah.
And I think, I was looking for it more on the second viewing, but I think there are moments in this movie where his actually having young Harrison Ford's face is uncanny in certain shots.
The one for me that was just like, fuck. Hey, that's the explicit warning. Again, spoilers, but his last scene with Enfys, which is the one where he calls her kid, and he does a little hand, a tiny little pointing, bye bye kind of gesture, and his face just does a kind of acknowledging leaving thing, and it's just Harrison Ford. It's really spot on, and there's a kind of there's almost a sort of Casino Royale kind of logic in this, in which he's not Han Solo until the end, but that sort of gradually coming through, because I mean, also she's the first person he can kind of legitimately call kid, I guess. I was really impressed with him. We had different levels of nerves about this movie during production, I guess, because I think I was slightly more thrown by the Lord Miller thing, which is probably just me being a bit not conservative, but I always get worried when directors leave projects. But the Alden Ehrenreich thing was never what I was worried about. And I was always surprised that was such a, there was such a fan backlash against him. And I think still the only other thing I've seen him in is Hail Caesar. But my memory of seeing Hail Caesar at the cinema was that it's one of the only times I've left a film and, turned to someone and said, God, that guy's a star. A film-stealing performance from someone you didn't know and, didn't know anything about. He's just really charismatic and magnetic in that movie. And yeah, I thought he was great. It's a really difficult job he had to do. And I think he nailed it. I think he did a really great job.
Yeah, the moment for me is to be honest, he looks most like Harrison Ford in profile, mm-hmm. but the moment towards the end of the movie where Kira and Han are heading up in the turbo lift to see Dryden Voss again.
Yeah.
And that side shot of him, and it just is Harrison Ford. Yeah. It's really something.
Yeah.
And also the thing I like about his performance is, so I feel like, and again, we're getting into that surrounding conversation territory again, but for me, so Han's a really interesting character because he lives in people's imaginations to some extent more than he lives in the movies.
Yeah.
Because Han is never the character that has to shoulder the movie, mm-hmm. ever. He's actually, so Harrison Ford, I'm not going to say that Harrison Ford had an easy job with the original Star Wars trilogy, but I'd say that he had a much easier job than Mark Hamill did.
Yeah.
Shouldering, particularly in Empire, where mm-hmm. he was given the best parts of the script to work with and improvise around, and a really compelling human relationship to bounce that film, to get through that film on. Whereas Mark Hamill spends that entire movie talking to a Muppet.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, and Darth Vader. And so,
it's incredibly rude to Darth Vader.
Yeah. you know what I mean? Han has always been the character people love because he sits on the sidelines and is too cool for everything that's going on. And then I think as a character that's badly served by Return of the Jedi, the fact that Han dies early in the earliest scripts of that movie is blindingly obvious from the fact that he doesn't have anything to do and nothing really to learn.
Yeah.
And his entire kind of character bounce at the end of Return of the Jedi is, oh, he's your brother? Great.
Cool.
There are fun moments, but he looks out of place in the teddy bear village and so on, right? The whole point of saying that is to say that, I have a question about can Han Solo hold a movie up by himself, actually? Because, I think Force Awakens is a great kind of return for that character as well and a good end to that character's arc. So,
I think is an interesting point as well, because I feel like I haven't read much about this movie, but I think, an interesting, and maybe this is something to talk about once we've talked about the plot of the movie more, but the the natural instinct with seeing a young Han Solo, obviously, and having Lando and having the meeting with Chewie, is to connect this story and that performance to original trilogy Han and original and like young Harrison Ford performance. But there are enough interesting beats in that story that hit on Force Awakens age Solo. Well, and also like, it seems slightly unnatural to do this because it's even though these are the two recent films you've seen, but even just like little parallels in terms of the like throne room stuff with his literal son, like Alden Ehrenreich's huge son.
Yeah, exactly. You know, my beefy boy.
And the Dryden Boss stuff at the end. There's like, and just the layers of you know, learning not to trust people versus how Han Solo actually dies. You know, so there's interesting. I think there'd be something to be said about not just viewing this, which it totally makes sense to view this through the lens of just like Harrison Ford's incredible performance as young Han Solo. But in the sort of bigger world of Star Wars, it's an interesting movie to link up to what we're watching now in the sequel trilogy.
Yeah, I really want to talk about it as almost the opposite movie of The Last Jedi in some ways.
Yeah.
But speaking specifically about Han, like, so there are things that, like, I think, yeah, so I think Alden Ehrenreich nails it basically as the character and is believably a younger version of that character.
Yeah.
I think, and there are lots of things, but, so, and this will be true, I think, of my take up on the film as a whole. He's very entertaining to watch. However, I feel like, actually, I feel like Han doesn't change much over the course of the movie. And in a way, it almost recontextualizes him. Like, I guess the best way to say it is, it feels like the purpose of Solo as a Han Solo story is to give you a little bit more information with which to appreciate the character you know in other films.
Yeah.
Rather than to show you a different side of him necessarily. Or to challenge that character in any way, really. Like, I feel like this is maybe the story of Solo as a whole for me. It's a movie I really enjoy, but I don't feel it actually challenges any of its characters or its audience, really, at all. And so the weakness of Han, and this particularly settles around Han as a character, because it's a movie that he spends sort of wanting something and then kind of getting it, and then wanting something else and then getting that as well, right? Like, maybe that's not quite right.
I mean, I feel like, I guess, surface level, I guess the character arc, and again, this is totally in service of the original trilogy. But this is really obvious, but what they seem to be establishing was that if you take all the Kira stuff at face value, that he is the good guy, he's the good kid, and this is the movie of him learning, to not be, so that you'll get to see it on the flip side. And that only really gets anchored in, I guess, him becoming Han who shoots first, which I guess is kind of the story, and him becoming the guy who doesn't want to join the rebellion. You know what I mean? And though that's not really anchored in that much, it's just kind of like, nah. even though he accidentally kind of kickstarts or like fuels the rebellion. That's him. I think that's what they were sort of aiming to scope out, was how do you go from a kid who, and this is all sort of said and not shown necessarily, I guess they're trying to have their cake and eat it too, in that on one hand, he just wants to get back to Corellia, he just wants to be with Kira, he just wants to get away. But then there's this like insistent that no, he's the good guy, so he has to learn to not be. That seemed to be what they were setting up in order to make it, you know, in order to make it the original trilogy, the return to like who he originally was. I'm not sure how well that's actually anchored to his like choices and what you see in the film, but that seemed to be what they were doing.
Yeah, and I wonder to what extent, like, you're right that there's a sort of mirroring of what's going on in the sequel trilogy with, like, you know, the notion that Han is sort of just inherently good and trying to do the right thing as things to reflect on Kylo Ren specifically
as a
character. I can sort of buy, like, I can basically, this is what I'm saying, is I can buy the story that Han has always been kind of, inherently kind of affected by other people suffering and ultimately wants to help, even if he doesn't want to show it because he sees it as weakness, that kind of thing. It does change his arc somewhat. Well, it changes it from being the rebellion is the thing that teaches him that quality to being the rebellion is the thing that allows him to do it consistently, which is a different journey.
Well, I mean, I guess what I would take from this movie, which isn't in this film, but is kind of what this film leads you to expect, is that you're supposed to see, well, I guess there are these two models of what happens to like the good kids who grew up in hell. And one of them makes it rationalizes it and makes the decision that it's better to be in power. And you don't really get to see him respond to that betrayal. So I think that is what's supposed to, even though like, yeah, you see him like literally like the sort of shoot first moment or whatever before Kira leaves on the yacht. That seems to be, that's the origin story for Han, who doesn't give a shit, is that,
right.
But we don't see that in the film. I think because it's, I got the impression that that would be like, it's sort of like the implied next film, or the implied, you already know how he becomes, this is why, is that he had this sort of romantic desire to get back and this just like, just getting away kind of thing. And then, the betrayal, which again, you don't really get the emotional response to, but is her choosing, everyone chooses power at the end, or everyone is in league to someone. And like, so he's just looking after himself. That seems to be, and that sets up, you know, A New Hope, Han, I guess.
I think, so for me, I think there's a sort of, one thing that makes that slightly more complex is that, you know, so I would agree with you that, you know, for example, him shooting first at the end of the movie and that being such a big beat does work as a kind of, this is how he became that guy.
Yeah.
But unfortunately for Star Wars in general, maybe fortunately for fans, but and so on, that cannot not be extremely meta.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Filmmaking, yeah. Because that is an explicit rejection of the most controversial change that George Lucas made to his own movies.
Yeah.
So it is explicitly, textually, it's not even subtext. That is a total rejection of a decision that George Lucas made about Han Solo in the 90s.
Yeah.
George Lucas decided that Han Solo is not the guy who shoots first.
Yeah.
And wanted to slightly ruin a scene in his most famous movie to make that point. And obviously fans didn't like him. So building the film to that point, I think this is the reason that I guess I feel like I really enjoy the performance and I really enjoy the movie, but I struggle to get like a theme or an arc for Han out of it without all of this meta stuff, because it's almost impossible to extract it from the story they ended up telling, if that makes sense. Like, it's impossible to appreciate that moment as a Star Wars fan and not see it as a little wink from the production team.
It's so much more, like you say, it's more than a wink. You know, it is literally, because it's not just that it's a scene in which he shoots first. It's a scene, you know, in like any kind of interaction. Literally, they talk about it like that was a smart move. Like, it's text in the film that it was smart for him to, you know. I think for me, the clankiest, hat tip was the kind of unnecessary, I think it's the character named Rio, the pilot, when he's like, maybe I'll set up a cantina somewhere hot. And then he dies. Like, no, I won't. But like, that was the only one that really that was not necessary for me. Like, generally speaking, I feel like they were pretty good. I mean, again, I'm saying this as someone who experienced this on a relatively like light and fun level. I enjoyed most of the tip hatting.
Yes. Yeah. It's that thing of it can't avoid being meta in those moments.
Yeah.
Which is a thing that, maybe just rather than get too deep on Han, we should talk about the other principal characters in the movie. I'd be interested. So actually, speaking of hat tipping and also extraordinary renditions of other people's characters, can we talk about Lando?
Yes.
When I saw, because I know I was skimming ahead through the plot a little bit, but like when I saw the movie today, there was a man behind me, a very posh man, who said exactly two words out loud during the entire film. One was Lando, and the other was cool.
All right, skipping ahead in the plot, but I will just share the only excellent audience interaction I had today, which was I went to the loo after the film, and when I came out again, I saw a man who I'd seen in the film, and he was on the phone, and I just heard the beats. No, I thought he was dead. Robot legs. And I know the phone conversation he was having. Anyway, but that's getting ahead. Yeah.
So Lando. Again, like as with the sort of Han Solo performance, there are moments where Donald Glover just is Billy Dee Williams. Like
he's enjoying it so much as well. Like he knows exactly what kind of film he's in. He knows the level of like fun with which to have in this film. Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be in this film.
I am a bit of a number one Lando fando in general. I love Lando a lot. And I would often go to bat for Lando as one of the standout characters, like actually having a genuinely interesting thing to do in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
In fact, Lando kind of steals Return of the Jedi from Han.
Yeah.
Because he gets to fly the Millennium Falcon around, showing how his sort of smuggler savvy is saving the Rebel fleet from a trap and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas Han just sort of...
hangs out in Teddy Bear Village.
Yeah.
And gently defrosts over a period of days.
And that is another one of those relationships that is sort of always teased at and not dug into except in sort of the extended material. And it's so good here from the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, the sort of... the fact that they don't... the fact that they never really both want the same thing from any given situation, but they're both going at the same things at the same time in different ways and sparking off each other completely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is so good. And Donald Glover is obviously having so much fun in that role. Because it's Lando's destiny to lose this movie, basically.
Right, yeah.
He has to lose this movie.
Yeah.
But he you never see it.
I would say, I do feel like he doesn't have, he has less to do than I expected.
Yes.
And that's like a little disappointing, but what he does with it was, for me, was great. Both on I'm glad he had like a few little character moments, even like the like Lando's journal moment and that kind of stuff.
I don't know if you know what those are direct references to.
No, I don't.
They are the plot of the Calrissian Adventure book series, like a real expanded universe.
Oh, that's
novel
amazing.
Series.
That's great.
It's no longer canon, but it's now been recanonized as a Hollow series that Lando
really
makes about himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like.
And like, no, I thought he did a great job. He, like again, that sort of balance of like the humor of it, but, and playing it like enough of the Billy Dee vocal mannerisms while also convincingly being younger. And convincingly being like that bit, it's been a while since I watched, Empire, but all of Han's initial stuff, if I remember it correctly, is the like, man, you're a professional now. What happened? And like he like is really convincingly like in that kind of middle spot between like being a pirate and like professionalizing, basically. And like
there's a bit in when they're landing on Kessel and he says, "I hate mining colonies."
Yeah,
like, everyone gets the job they hate eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
There's also there's a lovely, it's a reversal. It turns something that happens later into a reversal. So when they show up on Bespin in The Empire Strikes Back, and Lando initially
it's exactly like the end, but in reverse, right?
And they do that. But that turns out now that was actually Lando kind of getting revenge for a trick that Han pulled on him.
Yeah.
That's really nice. The best line in the movie is, "I hate you, I know.
Perfectly done to the extent that like not only do people like not groan at it, a lot of people didn't seem to notice it, which I think is how well that line is delivered. It's because it's not oversold. It's not like, you know, because it's obvious when you clock it, but like there were only a couple people in my theater that were like, that's a weird noise to make.
Worthy line.
But it wasn't like a like, I see what you did there. You know what I mean? Which it could have been like delivered less, you know, neatly.
Yeah. I think Lando gains more depth from this movie in some ways than Han does.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically in terms of like what his life is like. So when before the movie came out, someone said in an interview, I think it might have been Kasdan, that Lando is pansexual.
Yeah.
Right? And I saw someone on Twitter saying, like, if you're going to say that, don't sort of JK Rowling that and have it just be sort of applied to it. If you're going to say that, show us. Like, and obviously, it's a 12A movie, and there's actually, like, and Star Wars never has, like, a tremendous amount of sex in it. Like,
yeah.
I think Rian Johnson said that the moment where Rey and Kylo's hands touch, Hans touch.
That's a really weird, like, I've named my hands after my father. Don't ask too much about that. Hands and fathers are a big deal in this universe. They're always falling off.
But, like, that is, like,
that was quite a good joke. Carry on.
It was, yeah.
Thank you.
good. What I'm saying is, like, that's a rare moment of actually like, physical intimacy in Star Wars. They're not tend to be movies where people, like, do more than kiss and actually.
And now everyone's making out in a cloak closet.
Indeed. But, But actually, like, this is by far the Star Wars movie that makes the most sort of explicit references to people's attraction to one another.
Yeah.
And it is very clear that Lando thinks Han is hot.
Yeah.
Like,
adorable.
The line, "you're adorable," is so good.
And yeah.
Because that, you know, that scene, that first game of Sabacc, like, I think, you know, we should get onto this, but there are some weaknesses to Han, because he is, I think, what a lot of nerds think Rey is. He's mm-hmm. good at everything.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not really clear that he's played Sabacc before, but I'm extremely good at it.
I think it is just the fact that, like, he pronounces it correctly with Kira and then pronounces it incorrectly at the table seem to be him, right, like, indicating that he's, you know.
Yeah. See, this is the thing. That's a really good point. And I interpret it as a very meta thing as well. Because in Empire, Lando always calls Han Han.
No, yeah, I know. That is
meta. And so they bounces
meta.
That off.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they bounce that into a meta thing about how there's, like, two characters who can't pronounce Han.
I thought the Sabacc thing was his way of getting himself to be underestimated.
Right. Okay, yeah. I actually do buy that. I think what I'm saying is not that, like, it's more that, like, Han's sort of omni-capableness, which is fun. It's fun to watch. It's part of the fun part of the movie. If, like, it could lack interest in those scenes if the purpose of those scenes is just for Han and Lando to be fun at each other. And so having this extra element of, like, Lando might fuck him.
Yeah.
Is, like, just, it's nice. Like, it's just nice to have that sort of depth to Lando as a character. That, like, the fact that, so, that the line, like, "buckle in, baby," was in all of the trailers. The fact that he actually says that to Han.
Yeah.
Is so cool, and it's just really nice to see that in a Star Wars movie. Because I actually bought it all the way through the movie. Like, when they climb out of the Falcon after Han crash lands it at Severin at the end of the film, and Han then puts his arm around Lando in a kind of, like, "I crashed your spaceship," and Lando just looks completely destroyed. His shirt's been torn.
Yeah.
You know, he's been shot in the arm. His revolutionary robot mother girlfriend is dead. All of this sort of other sort of stuff has happened, and then the physicality is all one way at that point, and their relationship is so kind of sparky and fun and genuinely flirtatious.
Yeah, it's interesting. Really, I didn't think it was as flirtatious as you did, but I totally see chemistry.
Basically, I mean, that's the thing. Like, that's you know, I think for me, I actually bought it as, like, because Lando is the biggest flirt in the original trilogy as well. Like, he's, you know, the hello world.
Leia.
You know, and the fact that he obviously has some kind of history with Kira.
Yeah.
Like, or she has some kind of history with him.
Yeah.
Is sort of right there. And I don't know, I actually bought it as, you know, like, Han being a straight guy and Lando being a pansexual or a bisexual guy. Like, and that just being who they were and how they related to each other and how they sparked off each other. And it felt very natural and human to me, which I just, just really, really
enjoyed.
It was
nice. And, I think all of his dynamic with everyone, I think, was spot on. Good job. What else does that say about Lando in this movie? That I want to see more, ideally. Like,
There's a lovely moment where it's in when they're escaping from Kessel. And, like, Lando comes out of the Falcon firing Han's blaster in one hand and his own blaster in the other one. And then he throws the blaster to Han. And then there's just, like,
a
long
shot. There's, like, a long shot of him that's really good.
Yeah. And it's a real hero shot. Yeah. And it's total fan service, but it's Chewie and Lando and Han underneath the Falcon firing blaster pistols off screen. That is total.
I am not beneath
universe,
that. You know what?
Cover.
I'm not
either.
I mean, above it. Wait, I am beneath it. I mean, I'm in it. What?
Yeah.
Where am I?
It is the pure fan service that, and we should get onto this later, but it's the pure fan service that The Last Jedi wanted to make more complicated.
Yeah.
But here it is, right? Here's the thing you want to see. And I enjoyed that for as much as it can be, like, an easy win, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's worth talking about Chewie as his own kind of.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing about the movie, genuinely.
Okay.
My biggest surprise, and this sentence is going to end probably not what I expect, my biggest surprise in this movie is I'm sexually attracted to Chewbacca.
Okay, good.
See, talking about
Lando. I came out of it like Lando, but I was like Lando going in. No, so there was, you know.
I don't know what's going on there, honestly. I've thought about it a bit because I thought, well, I'm going to say that. So how do I explain that? And I don't have any answers for you. I'm just into Chewbacca now. Yeah. And what's weirdest about that is that it started with the beast sequence. So apparently I'm into, like, like mud slick chained up to
soggy
like,
Chewbacca.
Which is even fucking weirder.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just, I don't know if I'm into Jonas, whatever his name is, and it's like, I don't know what's going on there, but that was a, that happened twice now. I've seen the movie twice, so that's interesting to me, just as a human. No one else is going to be interested in that, but that's, I did learn something about myself from this movie. No, I thought the, I thought the intro they did for Chewie was, that was my, like, that's the bit of the movie I think they nailed the best. Like, in terms of like, because I didn't necessarily think I needed to see their, like, meet cute, but I genuinely didn't see it coming. And and so that moment of like being thrown into a thing with an animal is a very classic Star Wars-y thing, or it will become one. Which just make me think that there's like a different draft of Return of the Jedi where like Luke speaks Rancor and then they're just like best buds for the rest of time.
Indeed. Well, this is the thing, right? It's implied in that movie that when they were stuck in the trash compactor in A New Hope and there's that little snake thing.
Yeah.
That's just a little baby version of the woman that Han worked for.
Oh,
on
yeah.
Corellia, oh, apparently. God. They're probably not, right? They're probably different species. Yeah. But, like, you know.
One fun fact I will throw out about Lady Proxima is that it's the same actress as Grandmother Willow from Pocahontas.
Huh.
So, enjoy that, fans of trees. Mm. So maybe there isn't that much more to say about Chewie apart from my own personal issues. But, I really thought the Chewie stuff was done really well. Like really fun. I know I was surprised how much I enjoyed that. They as both like a set piece and like a logical way for them to meet. I just like that was like the probably like purest blast of just like fan pleasure, and I really enjoyed it. And what's the Wookiee like? Is it Shriwook? Is that
Shriwook?
Thank you.
It's the language.
That whole sequence with the subtitles, I thought they did like a great job with that. And yeah, Chewie is my surprise. I mean, I guess Lando is like the real MVP, but Chewie is like my surprise runner-up MVP.
There's a few nice things that I like about it. So like the story of how Han and Chewie met is a pretty old one in Star Wars.
Yeah.
There's some similarities, not loads. But the main thing they've changed is they basically remove the life debt, which I'm really glad of.
Yeah, no, I noticed, yeah.
There's a moment where this is maybe talking about Han almost not having so much of an arc because he sort of shows himself to be the Han we know a little bit earlier than you'd expect. So mm-hmm. there's the moment when they're escaping Kessel and Chewie obviously wants to go help the Wookiee slaves, including, I think, his wife.
I don't know how clear that is other than like the head butt hug thing.
There's a name that's shouted that sounds a lot like Chewie's wife's name from the expanded universe.
Yeah.
But, you know, who don't know. But anyway, but like, and Chewie wants to go, and then Han's like, fine, go then, and then hands him the force pike thing.
Yeah.
Which is very much a kind of, I respect your desire to go off and liberate your people gesture, which is the sort of thing, it's a very Han to Luke gesture in a later movie. It's the sort of like, you know, don't get yourself killed, but best of luck kind of thing. I respect your journey, Han gesture. They're like, and that almost being the basis for the respect between them.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than it being Han saves Chewie's life, so Chewie swears to follow him around forever.
Yeah,
well, also I think like, a lot stronger.
And also their dynamic isn't as, you know, I mean, their dynamic in the original trilogy is far more Han is in charge than it is here, and so it'd be interesting to sort of like justify like when that shifts and how. I mean, just beyond like being second mate, like beyond being a co-pilot, when does he like even that like line just after they get picked up. I realize we haven't talked about any of the like big new characters yet, but like just after they get picked up and there's like I think Han says something like, no, they picked you up because of me, like the implication being that Han said like Chewie said they only picked you up because of me. Like Chewie has more power than Han.
He's
when
barges into the shower for that.
But, yeah, exactly.
Didn't know he wanted.
I mean, again, so much I didn't know I wanted. it'd be kind of funny to watch any of the sort of scenes in the original trilogy where Han is basically just telling Chewie what to do in light of like...
Sort of. Like, I mean, it's always like, you know,
with remember that, it's... like that thing, you know.
Yeah, but it's also like it's Chewie that introduces Ben Kenobi to Han.
Yeah.
In the cantina, right? Yeah. And in A New Hope. There are things that, like, I think I sort of like the fact that Chewie is just kind of chill. Like, that's the thing it establishes about Chewie, is he's just like, okay, I'm doing this.
Unless you're
like,
playing chess, he's just real chill, yeah.
Yeah, there's such a nerdy thing in that scene. When they're playing to Jarek on the table, and Chewie smashes the table, the two pieces he destroys, the two of the holograms wink out
and
break. The two he breaks are two production models that were made for A New Hope but never used.
That's incredible.
It's just the deepest, nerdiest cuts. But yeah, that's, you know, that was, yeah, a neat thing. I also really liked, they showed Chewie flying the Falcon. Like, that I didn't quite pick up on the first time I saw it. Like, the bit where they do a cool skid is both Han and Chewie flying the Falcon together.
Yeah.
And I think that's it ties to something. It's almost a mirroring of Chewie flying the Falcon at the end of The Last Jedi, in both in terms of the set piece, flying, being chased by TIE fighters through a narrow environment full of rocks.
Mm-hmm.
The color scheme is an inversion. And, you know, what Chewie does is the same. And that's a kind of a neat bit of mirroring. Like, and that gives you that bookend of, like, not much has changed for Chewie. He's 190.
Yeah, he's 190 years old. Yeah, this is a relatively short, like,
year. It's like 50 years later, I guess, or 45 years later. Yeah. Last Jedi, you know, I mean, he's doing the same thing. I thought it was a nice arc for him. At some point, he has to wear one bundle.
Basically, his arc is, I've gone from, in horrifying conditions, I will eat humans, to, oh, porgs. but yeah, so I enjoyed Chewie a lot. That was probably the most fun I had. It's nice seeing him running around being all limber. No offense to Peter Mayhew, but he's real limb. Man, I am attracted to Chewie. This is
weird. Good.
Cool.
Good, we've all learned something.
Should we talk about the new characters?
Yeah, I thought we should do new characters in a kind of batch, because I think,
you
know, most of them, like, as with Rogue One, most of them are going to leave this movie.
Well, that's an interesting point, because, like, So it was funny, earlier you said, can you hang a movie on Han Solo? And this film, I don't think, tries to, because it does make it definitely an ensemble film. As much as he's, like, the central guy in every scene he's in, and he's in every scene, as far as I can tell, pretty much, it does have a, like, quite, I think, quite vivid ensemble. And, the thing I would say about it is that, I don't necessarily need that many more individual stories set like before the original trilogy. Like, I'm not, like, dying out. I understand they're going to do a Boba Fett movie. I'm sure there's going to be others. I'm not actually, like, super crying out for that. But I don't mean to be mean to Emilia Clarke. The slight caveat that I think this would work better with a different actress. This film is a really good backdoor origin story for a fantastic villain. Or also a origin story for Enfys Nest. Either of those characters, having seen what you see in this movie, could totally have their own film. Specifically, Kira, I think. I do feel like Emilia Clarke isn't the world's strongest actress. I think this is probably the best I've seen her, in that she's not she's not, like, bad at all, but she's just not doing a lot with it. And, like, I think if you'd gone with a slightly, like, more of, like, a character, I don't know if character actors are a bit of a bullshit phrase, but just someone who got their teeth into a bit more the potential of that, of that sort of arc to, like, becoming head of a huge crime syndicate would be really interesting, and an interesting movie about her is, it would be possible, but I don't necessarily want to see it with Emilia Clarke, because I don't necessarily want to see it. But that whole arc of, and it's of, you know, like, two people picking two different ways to deal with growing up, serving people, and what power, and, like, and deciding whether that's about, like, I just want to fly away, or I want power, and, like, figuring out what the best thing to do is. And it's, you know, obviously with her relationship with Maul and everything, I can think of so many interesting ways she could become a really interesting villain in a Star Wars film. Ideally not one with Han in, because I think that's even more interesting. But, like, that, so I really like that character. Actually, and I also really did like her, like, fight choreography and stuff. Like, I just don't think Emilia Clarke's the best actress. It didn't take me out of the film. It wasn't like it was distracting, but just, you could imagine that someone could really get their teeth into it.
I think it's interesting. I think there's sort of, like, Kira as a character is the one who I feel, like, needed. So there are things about the script for the movie in general.
Yeah.
Particularly with the new characters, that feel a bit like casting on autopilot.
Yeah.
In terms of sort of Hollywood expectations of how certain characters are going to work.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you that I think that she does make for an interesting foil for Han in terms of different reactions to growing up in exactly the same environment.
Yeah.
However, I feel like that story attached to that particular kind of female lead in a movie, particularly a movie that centers around a male character's experience, has kind of been done quite a lot. Like, the I've been forced into a sort of I kind of attained power through servitude. Mm-hmm. And I've done things I can't be forgiven for, sort of femme fatale thing.
Yeah.
Is I feel a bit played out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I feel the most recent Star Wars films have managed to avoid.
Yeah.
More often than not. Like, Jin in Rogue One. Is actually like, you know, a similar sort of, not a similar character necessarily, but, it's, that's a, you know, she's a very vivid character to me in terms of what she wants and how she changes and her mm-hmm. kind of anger at her situation and her desire to not get involved and then her desire to get involved. And then her sacrifice and things is actually quite a vivid arc for me that I don't think either Han or Kira get in this film at all, really. Similarly, you know, sort of Rey's situation, which is the heart of the new trilogy or the new movies, is very distinct from that kind of traditional journey of, like, what do you do if you're disempowered in that situation? Whereas Kira, subservient to Paul Bettany's character, sort of, yeah, the Kung Fu femme fatale thing, it just felt so out of a certain Hollywood playbook.
I think
I struggled to connect with it.
That's interesting. You're right that it's a trope, but I also... I was watching like a movie in my head, but like I can still imagine it working with maybe an actress that just had more because I can the sort of strategic subservience, because I think you see a lot of, or there's the potential to see a lot of like weighing up choices with how you're going to handle every situation. I mean you're right that like you say femme fatale, it's literally like a very noir-y character. But that doesn't mean I would be less interested in seeing... I would be interested in seeing that character, like, running a crime syndicate and seeing what happened to her and being able to relate that to, like, the history of what you know about Han, but it not being about him. Like, I would still be interested in that. So that's something that... And for me, it's not that it was too... trite to ever work. It's that I just don't think, and again, it sounds like I'm being really, I'm not meaning to like just pick on Emilia Clarke too much, but I just don't think she brought out the potential of it. And I think that's in the character because like a lot of the Star Wars characters are fairly recognizable tropes in that way. And it's the individual actors that bring out, Han being a good example. Harrison Ford.
Yeah. I think there are things that do and don't work. Like, I really like the line, when Han says, "You don't know everything," and she says, "No, but I know a little bit more than you."
Yeah.
That's a really good moment. And I think if it was, and there are moments that, like, I really like the bit where, again, like little moments I really like in that form. It's like when Han says, "We need to," even though it's a scene that ends up becoming about Chewie, but like, you know, "We need to boost the rear deflector shields." And she goes, "Yep, we definitely do." In a way that communicates, "I have no idea how to do that."
Yeah.
Which is something that people don't often do in Star Wars. Like, it felt, that sort of fun. Maybe even a little shadow of the Lord Miller version of this film
there. Yeah.
But at the same time, like, her and Emilia Clarke and Woody Harrelson get given the worst lines in the movie. And we'll get to Woody Harrelson, but her final kind of farewell to Han, the smile thing, that's a clunker and a half.
It is, and like, the second time was only, it was only the second time I remembered the setup of that. Because it's a weird word to, it's a weird way to talk about a verb. it's a really odd way to talk about a verb. Because it'd be one thing if it was like, the one thing, I mean, this is terrible, and like, if this was in the screenplay, I'd shoot me. But like, it'd be one thing if it was like, about like an object or it was like, "You know what my favorite cube are? Dice." I mean, that's terrible. But you know, but it's like angry. You know what the word was? Smile. It's a poor writerly way, but it's not a human thing that you would anchor. You wouldn't remember that you've trailed off the conversation before you said the verb.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also not sufficiently strong feeling.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the point is that like,
yeah, I guess
it's for how it's not like it's that isn't, that's, you know, it's not about, you know, it's not about winning the game, it's how long you stay in it, whereas all he represents is like happiness, which is like fleeting and shallow, but she still has a soft spot for it, you know, she kept the dice, whatever, whereas like it's not real, it's not lasting, it's a, you know, ephemeral. Like, there's things you can do with that would work, but yeah, as a line, it doesn't, And so, like, both times I've watched it, like, it just feels like she's saying to him to smile, and he's like, and then he smiled, and like, oh, good, he's very handsome.
It's like, yeah. It's like there, and again, there, I'm saying that almost to, because I agree with you, I don't think Emilia Clarke is a very strong actress in this film. But I'm saying that's almost excused part of that performance. Like, I think she's given a role that can be quite rote in places. Yeah. And there are parts where it does sort of work. Like, I like her in undercover as the sort of trade delegate wearing a cool cape. Like,
yeah.
I like those moments, and those in which the character kind of worked for me. I think there are elements of her character particularly that... It's not that she's anything like Leia necessarily, so much as Han definitely has a type.
Yeah.
Which, again, is one of those sort of, you know... It might have been nice to be more surprised by the person that Han was in love with as a young man, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Rather than it being like, guess what he really likes?
Tiny brunettes.
Small, authoritative brunettes. Like, that's...
Yeah. It's just like, his just the age range just went lower. It's like...
Yeah, well, I stayed the same, actually.
Like, teenage her was, like, the peak, I guess.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Which kind of makes sense in a way. Mm. Damn, Han. Damn. What a use of internet technology at that moment.
Indeed.
The character actually worked for me, I think the character worked for me more than it did for you, but maybe that's because it's the parts where it fell flat to just not the most dynamic performance. I don't think she's bad in the film, I just think that she's not pulling out what's the potential of that character.
I think so. There's something that maybe we'll link to other characters as well, but it's things I like and don't like about the movie. So the thing I like about the movie in general is that it establishes like something that all the Star Wars movies are doing a decent job at is that universe is getting more and more rich in really cool female characters, which Star Wars badly needed, right? Like, there's a lot more. Like, there's just a lot. You know, you have Enfys Nest and. Fandy Newton, whose character name has
Val.
Escaped me. On, Val. Is on
Which I think record. it escapes you because she doesn't get enough to do, I think.
She doesn't get enough to do, but a lot of Star Wars characters don't get more to do than simply be a kind of icon and then vanish.
Yeah.
And, like, and it is to Star Wars' credit, and I say this with deliberate pinch of salt, that it is giving that sort of presence to women as well as Muppets. Which is where previously it was pretty much just Muppets.
Yeah.
Which is a weakness of the original trilogy. And that's good. And I think it recontextualizes some things about Han. Like, Han in A New Hope can come across as a bit of a prick for a particular reason, is that he kind of dismisses Leia out of hand as just this princess.
Yeah.
And actually something I think this movie does do successfully for me, and this is obviously generosity, and this is anachronistic because that movie is just, A New Hope is quite naive in that way, and you know, of its time. But it sort of establishes that Han has always known sort of some pretty strong men and women of all types, basically.
Yeah.
So he's not going to be impressed by a princess until she, you know, and he's maybe even distrustful of that kind of privilege necessarily, based on who he knows. And that is a sort of enriching of that fiction that does definitely work for me.
Yeah.
The thing that I find... maybe something that doesn't quite work for me, but Kira, is that, so we're told that she's done things she can't account for. Mm-hmm. And we should talk about what they might be based on who her boss turns out to be, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we're really given no clue what that might actually mean. Like, because Star Wars, you know, like, it really is, like, Star Wars hasn't given you the vocabulary to know what that might be, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and for that reason, it strikes a real sort of act of telling rather than showing, if that makes sense.
Oh, like, it's funny. I kind of felt the opposite. Like, I felt like it would have been heavy-handed to say it. I felt like it was more generative to leave it open. But
Yeah, I think I sort of... I'm not arguing... Like, Star Wars is becoming more socially aware, I guess, is a thing. And it's something that L3 gives voice to in this movie in a different context with droids.
Which is funny because that's the part of the thing that full... Well, you finish your thought,
Fell flat for me as well.
Okay,
we'll get to
there,
right?
Yeah.
The reason I'm saying this is... So, we're introduced to, you know, Dryden Voss, Paul Bettany's character, and this new version of the criminal underworld. Sort of glitzy criminal underworld, somewhere between Jabba's Palace and Casino Planet from...
Cante Bight?
Cante Bight.
Although better production design than Canto Bight. Really good Star Wars production design. The production design across the board in this movie is really good, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Really Star Wars, but also inventive. Really like it.
So here's what I'm saying, right? This is just a point that I don't know if it's an end to, but it's something I was thinking about, is Jabba's Palace gave us quite a few, which is referenced in this movie, right? There's a big gangster on Tatooine.
Yeah.
Gave the Star Wars universe a few things to deal with in terms of its, you know, there's, it's basically what I'm saying is Jabba keeps slave women in metal bikinis. He feeds them to his rancor pets, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is established as a part of the fabric of this universe in a way that's never going to be hopefully returned to or addressed necessarily.
Yeah.
But it feels like it's almost like the films are doing other things to shore up and address and fix some of the, you know, some of the more great things, and it's absent from this film, and that's sort of, I don't know what I'm asking for necessarily, but yeah.
Well, I think for me, I mean, this is a kind of tangential point, and this goes back to Robot Rebellion, but also ideas of slavery, is for me, I mean, just to start with Robot Rebellion, that's it's totally fun in the film, and I enjoy it in the film. You don't want to think about it for too long, because it opens up so many cans of worms in terms of, the status of sentience and free will in droids that, it can't deliver on, and it's because it's funny, it's a gonk droid, like, stomping on a console unit. It's like, really, like, I genuinely like that made me laugh. It's really, but like, it's, obviously, like, they've always played with, like, 3PO and they don't serve your kind here, whatever. Like, they have gestured to that before, but they haven't gazed at it too long, because it's a huge can of worms. Okay, so which droids are sentient and why? Do they have free will? And I know there's, like, that sort of thing of, like, oh, this is, like, a bolt on its head. Like, why did you invent that bolt? Why does there, you know what I mean? Like, there's so much to say once you start unpacking that. But there's also, organic slaves as well as robot slaves. And so, like, all that stuff it's done to, because it's like a funny set piece, and because I think in theory they wanted people to take L3 stuff with that seriously, but even that, like, didn't quite work for me. Just even little things like the equal rights gag is just, just the phrase equal rights has such a specific 20th century history that it's, again, and to have that be something that, like, a black guy rolls his eyes at is, like, a little off. And then and then specifically with the way that slavery is treated in this movie, and, like, obviously slavery is a trans-historical concept, but the imagery that they predominantly use in this film, I mean, this is not the first time Star Wars has shallowly used, like, North African imagery. That's been part of Star Wars since, you know, the 70s, since A New Hope. But it comes to the fore more when the text of your film is literally about empires, colonialism, and natural resource extraction and slavery. The kind of shallow use of that kind of imagery, like, it's not a problem. I don't think it makes the film, like, fall apart, but it's just, what's the planet there at the end? Is it Severin? Severine. I was saying the name of it. Anyway. There are lingering shots of, like, black men and women who are wearing kind of clothes that evoke, like, North African dress and Muslim dress, but they have no lines. They don't speak, like, conspicuously don't speak. And they're doing that in a context where they'll explicitly talk about slavery 1 minute, and they talk about, like, genuinely the villain of this film is our empires that, you know, colonize planets. And it's just done kind of thoughtlessly, and in a way that, again, I don't think it's offensive. I just think it's undercooked, and, like, different people could bring so much more to that. And it is like a little distracting when then, yeah, like, in that planet at the end, none of those people have, like, any lines at all. This speaks to a broader kind of where slavery sits in the Hollywood imagination. It's a much bigger topic than this movie. And this movie isn't trying to do something heavy with it. It just exists as something that they evoke, but then don't deal with.
Right. I think maybe that's, I agree with you. And I think maybe that's what I was trying to say, is that, like, I don't, like, so L3's character and the kind of droid rights thing, which I think does clunkily, this gesture, uses too much real kind of terminology and kind of ways of phrasing.
Or, you know, or historically anchored, you know, specific terminology. Like, Equal Rights has such a specific American example history, you know.
And the fact that it reuses the line. So obviously all of that stuff springs out of the line, you know, we don't serve your kind here from A New Hope.
Yeah.
Which is quite an innocuous line in A New Hope, I think. Like, so now I don't think so, because of the way L3 contextualizes it.
Well, it's innocuous based on how much attention you pay on the fact that you're like, two of your fave characters, R2 and C-3PO, are, I mean, like, obviously you see them bought and, you literally see them bought and sold. But like, it's the fact that people can playfully evoke, like, servitude, like, buying sentient things like that is an after effect of the way that we the way that slavery is often a light part of culture, and that's just a bigger phenomenon. But those movies don't invite you to pay as much attention to it as this one half does with the rebellion thing.
That's what I'm saying, right?
Does that kind of make sense? Yeah.
It half invites you to do it, because it makes you like L3 and be happy when she sets off a kind of droid rebellion on Kessel that becomes a wholesale sentient act of liberation, right? It's not an accident. It's not just a robot uprising. It's the robots then free the humans and the Wookiees and the Twi'leks and everybody else. And like, and I agree, it ends up in an awkward place. And, you know, we could maybe draw on other aspects of L3 as a character, but, you know, on paper, I love the idea that the reason that the Millennium Falcon speaks in a strange dialect. To C-3PO L3's spirit, when Han is always talking to the Falcon, he's talking to L3 and her kind of like revolutionary spirit.
I love that.
Is in the Falcon. Lovely idea, except the fact that they're literally gambling with the Falcon later in the movie.
Yeah.
Which is like, still, it's weird then if the Falcon is sentient.
One thing I will throw out that a friend of mine was in town this weekend, and I don't remember making this claim. And this claim is a clearly like me ripping off Daniel Mallory Ortberg's vibe. But apparently I once claimed to my friend Emma that the Millennium Falcon is a magnificent lesbian. And my friend said, she is. This movie indicated you. So that is one. I mean, not that L3 is necessarily a lesbian, but certainly has a lot of lesbian energy going on. So I'm happy for anything that makes the Millennium Falcon being a magnificent lesbian canon.
Yeah, I like that as well. So I guess what I'm saying, and this is, I guess, a torturous point that I mishandled, I think, with Kira initially. But, so, with the way Kira is presented when you see her again in Dryden Voss's spaceship palace thing, his yacht, and she has been sort of, you know, she's in a beautiful dress now and her hair has been done.
Yeah.
She's sort of in full kind of beautiful Emilia Clarke mode, basically. But she's branded. She's explicitly his servant, slave, etc.
Slash lieutenant. Like it is.
It's a strange thing. For me, it doesn't feel like much of an evolution. Basically, so what I'm not saying is that the R3 stuff is entirely successful at taking something that was gestured at in the original movies and making it, and staring at it, because I think it only goes halfway and it leaves a lot of questions and stuff. However, I've always found it weird that Jabba the Hutt enslaves women specifically. Yeah. He's a slug beast.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's always seemed strange, and it's always seemed viewer gaze oriented in terms of what happens in Return of the Jedi. And for me, a combination of that sort of femme fatale trope being a trope to the sort of the casting and the production design and every aspect of that, where you have essentially what if Jabba the Hutt but Paul Bettany, and a new sort of I would say sexualized female slave. Like,
so one thing I would say that I think about that, one thing is that I really liked Paul Bettany in this movie.
Yeah,
and he's a good example of an actor getting their teeth into a role that isn't that much elevating it. So like, imagine like an actor of a similar level playing Kira. Because he doesn't have any classic lines, he just delivers them really well. He's just physically and like intonation, he's just really in it. So I like that stuff with him. The thing I'd say about like the sexual element of it is, I read it as there was a level of, I mean, there's obviously like there's touching and like he brings her over to him and all that stuff in a way that's quite common for that sort of imagery. Kira's line about like, always know your enemy's weakness. I always felt there was an element like her, the vague and sort of euphemistic way she talks about their relationship, especially when he explicitly calls her his lieutenant, can also be read as her doing what's necessary to keep kind of Han, what she thinks is going to let her play Han the way she wants to play Han. Mm. Like having him be afraid that she's, what the status she's, it just feels like there's a way you can play that character is like her keeping her options open in terms of what Han feel, and a very like sort of cliche base male fear is that like, oh, the woman I love is in this. So I think there's elements of that where you could play it differently. I'm just like what kind of level of power she has in this organization can be, and like why she would be. So I think there would be ways that you could get this away from not as to say that it isn't gross for superiors to be like weird and sexual with their underlings, but like but the audience is on Han's side in this. And if the audience is like reading in, that the situation is one in which she's being like sexually manipulated, do you get what I'm saying? That like, it can also be part of her like playing Han.
I guess so. Yeah. I think for me, there were sort of elements of it that I just didn't trust fully.
Yeah.
Be so thoroughly examined within the text.
Yeah. I honestly don't trust like Hollywood in general to do that stuff delicately. Yeah. But yeah, you should expect better. And yeah.
Yeah, because there is something I really like that is consistent between Solo and The Last Jedi, which is that it shows that the we should talk about Beckett and crew as well. Yeah. Like, I'd quite like to bounce and talk about Enfys Nest as a counterpoint.
Yeah.
So the reveal that Enfys Nest is not just a young woman, basically, a very young woman.
Yeah.
I really like, and the characters that she's surrounded by include Edrio Two Tubes, who you will subsequently see in Rogue One,
mm-hmm.
in Saw Gerrera's Partisans.
Yeah.
So that's a direct link from one to the other. Cool. Warwick Davis is there playing the character he plays in Phantom Menace. Annie's little childhood friend grows up to be a revolutionary.
Yeah.
But for the most part, but Warwick Davis and Enfys Nest, I don't know the name of the actress, and I've forgotten the name of Warwick Davis' character, are the only humans in that that group. And it's sort of this assorted group of aliens.
Yeah.
Of various types. And something the new Star Wars movies have done well, I think, and some of this surrounding matter has done well, is, and maybe this is an example of Star Wars taking something that was totally unintentional about the 70s, the original trilogy, and making it a thing that I think operates successfully as part of the thesis of Star Wars, which is the original movies are very human-centric. The Empire is predominantly humans, and the Rebellion is predominantly humans.
Yeah.
And aliens are sort of a sideshow. They're in the background of the cantina. Yeah. They're there to be cool Muppets, basically. Yeah. And the new movies have done a lot more to show that, the reason for that is because the aliens are actually pushed away from a lot of positions of power in different organizations, and that the seeds of the Rebellion, for example, isn't a bunch of dudes in 70s mustaches in flight suits in the army, nor is it the sort of senators and counselors and the, overwhelmingly human, overwhelmingly white, for example, people of the prequels or even Rogue One, in terms of the body of the Rebellion. It's sort of these sort of like ad hoc groups of people from the fringes of society.
Literally an alliance, because it's not really an alliance. Yes. We have a homogenous group of people.
Exactly. Yeah. And that includes, and maybe this is drawing that line again, but that, and so having a young female heroine at the center of that, as you said earlier, feeling like she could have her own movie.
Yeah.
Is a really nice way of, it's a retcon, but it's a way of saying, look, these people have always been in Star Wars in the background.
Yeah.
But, this is something I'm really interested in terms of the story that Star Wars ends up telling, that like when the Rebellion gets going.
Yeah.
And when it becomes a sort of hegemonic thing in its own right, the Rebellion starts to manifest some of the same patterns and shapes and structures as the Empire.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting.
And it makes me, It's funny, since the last time we did one of these, we've gone through the after effects of people being so divided over The Last Jedi, which even though we knew a little bit at the time, I don't think we anticipated people would be as divided as they are. But that just further, like, for me, just emphasized how happy I am with the direction they've gone with The Last Jedi and trying to, like, destabilize those kind of logics,
That is something that's contained in Fist Nest at the end of.
Yeah.
And that, in a way, I think in a way that almost helps Kira as a character.
Yeah.
Because it establishes, like, and it's very important, I think, that the movie does this, that Kira isn't its only sort of, a young person on the wrong end of a kind of criminal cartel.
Yeah.
In that
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, exactly. There are so many different choices that you can make. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, you don't have to serve Paul Bettany.
Or Ray Park.
Or Ray Park / Sam Witwer.
Although you totally understand why she would, like, I do think there's potential in the Kira character. I just don't think that, like, that potential is brought out. Like, you can totally empathize with why she would. I like Enfys Nest a lot. I wasn't super surprised. I don't know why. I thought in the trailer, like, that, oh, I bet there's going to be a woman. And I don't know why. I thought that when I saw the trailer, and I was like, I held on to that, and I was like, yeah, it is. She's younger than I expected, and I like the idea that she'd taken over her mother's mantle. So even if we're going to talk about wanting to make Star Wars less genealogical, there is something interesting about, like, a maternal lineage. And you don't see a lot of her, but, like, Star Wars is built on cool characters you don't see a lot of. It's nice rewatching the, like, train job sequence, knowing, like, kind of reading those guys as, like, the proto-rebels, like, trying to get fuel. Like,
yeah, I see them as, like, from a kind of canon point of view, I see them as, like, proto one cell of rebels, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, rather than proto the entire rebellion.
Not the rebellion, but yeah.
The reason I think that is simply because Han Solo accidentally founding the rebellion is a bit much for me in terms of neatness. But also because between Rebels and Rogue One, it's just like, you know, you see that the rebellion starts as all of these very different groups of people, and eventually they do come together. That one of those characters from Enfys Nest's Marauders will eventually become one of Saw Gerrera's partisans, and that's, there's a lot of different types of rebel for a while. And that's good and fine, yeah. Happy to see it. And that sequence reads very differently when you know that, as you're right, that train job.
I think the phrase train job probably can bring us through some other properties onto Beckett.
Yeah, Beckett and Gang as well.
Yeah, it's Firefly, which is fine.
Yeah, it is Firefly, which is fine. You have, what if Wash was an orangutan spider?
I also feel like I had to look up who it was, because Jon Favreau, which I didn't know. But, like, I do feel like Jon Favreau, you know, in the same way that, like, Benedict Cumberbatch, Hugh Laurie, and Damian Green. Damian Lewis. I don't know if they all went to Eton, but I feel like they all went to Eton and they all went to a class called American. I feel like Jon Favreau in this movie and Bradley Cooper as Rocket both went to the same school of
Of
Animal Pilot. Which is probably not Eton. I genuinely at first I thought, it's like, Bradley Cooper, has he really just, like, picked a niche and gone with it? That gang in general is, like, fun, and I the fact that I don't sound terribly enthusiastic isn't a criticism. I enjoyed all that stuff a lot. It's just
I think so. I think the comparison you make with them is to the kind of gang of misfits in Rogue One.
Yeah,
right. Where you get a lot Chirrut more characterization. And Baze and Cassian, and, like, maybe Cassian's too much of a main character. Yeah, I'd say Chirrut, Baze, and Bodhi in Rogue One are characters that are, you know, they get more screen time because they did die at the end of the movie rather than, like, at the end of the first act. Yeah. But they have a similar amount of time to say, this is who I am.
Yeah.
And they're all, I think, more interesting.
I think part of... I wonder how much of that is... a reflection of their, like, plot function, in that the gang serve a reflective, they reflect and they teach and they live in relation, I think, to to Han and Chewie. Whereas in Rogue One really benefits from the fact that it is an inherently kind of culminating film. Like, it really, the fact that you don't need to watch that, obviously on a plot level, yes, it's literally a setup to the first 5 minutes of A New Hope. But on a character level, you get total closure on those characters because they all fucking die. And you're not trying to do that game of like, this character is teaching this character this lesson. This character is in this part of this character's development.
They
get to be totally self-contained in a way that's rare in something that's a prequel. And so I wonder if that kind of like frees people up to make them actual, like, or put enough pressure on them to make them have to be whole characters, because they had to have a whole story that could be concluded with all of their deaths. Whereas, like, the gang is like, Beckett has stuff to do as like a specific foil for Han Solo, and them as a gang has stuff to do as a foil for his like life as someone who has one partner and otherwise is kind of independent. But they don't. But that's, again, it's all serving a purpose in relation to Han.
I think. Yeah, there's something about those that didn't quite work for me. Like, I love the in terms of production design, it's not a scene we'll probably return to in any other context, but the sort of World War One Imperial Army sequence near the beginning is so good.
Yeah.
And it's such, like, you know, I could nerd out about a lot of the things that, that the film does in terms of, drawing on other aspects of Star Wars, but that's one of them in terms of, like, you see a completely different side of the universe, and it's great. And the moment where you see Beckett for the first time in the film, when he's fighting in a way that the Imperial officers definitely don't.
Yeah.
And there's some really nice sort of production design presaging. So he's stolen that Imperial officer's uniform, which is Han recognizes that it's stolen because it's full of blaster holes.
Yeah.
But the blaster hole that's most prominent is in the exact place Han will shoot Beckett at the end of the film.
Yeah, that's really cool.
So there's a nice bit of just, you know, just.
And then, and you pointedly see that hole at the end as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, what was a lie at the start becomes a kind of a truth at the end. And they're a kind of like a wacky gang immediately. And then their deaths are, it's all like, there's something slightly off about that for me, simply because, so Rio dying, is a shame, but like, that's, he is a victim of the variable lethality of blaster bolts in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes you get shot in the shoulder and you just go, ow, and then you tell Han Solo that you love him, which is the Leia approach to being shot in the shoulder. Sometimes you get shot in the shoulder and you're like, don't worry, I've only been shot in the shoulder.
And then you full ass die.
And then you die to death. I didn't understand, for example, in two viewings, I don't really understand. It's Val, right? I keep getting it wrong. I don't understand
what she's doing.
Why she has to die?
No, me neither. Me neither. And I tried to pay attention to it the second time, and I still didn't figure it out.
So she blows herself up to destroy the bridge.
Yeah, which all that takes out is the train. Like, it doesn't help them on like, it's Chewie that unshackles the carriage from the previous carriage.
Yeah,
like, and the connect, like Empress Nest already has, they already have cables on it. So why did the bridge have to go?
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that it was the only way to take out the Viper droids that would have killed them. Maybe.
Yeah.
But she was shooting at the Viper droids. And that was working. So,
yeah, and it wasn't like, it didn't seem that it was like, this is on a timer and it's going to get me anyway. I'm going to try and blow it up at a strategic moment. It didn't seem like, it just seemed
like. And so there's a few things that are nested here, Enfys nested, that don't work for me. And so one is that, I don't really get why she has to die. Two, I did get that she has an actual relationship with Beckett.
Yeah.
That he is, like, Beckett's character. Sorry, would have actually worked a little bit better for me if this had just been the crew he was most recently using.
Yeah.
And that is kind of revealed at the end of the movie.
Well, I think I feel like there's a little element of that, like, the whole, like, we're low at the moment suggests that they've lost people. So that maybe they aren't as, like, tight a unit as they should be, but yeah.
But, like, but it's pretty much unarguable that Val is genuinely, you know, the most important person to him. And her death doesn't seem to affect him enough.
Which, in the second viewing, made me read their relationship more lightly. Because there isn't actually, like, because there isn't a huge moment where they have, like, I love you. They just, like, they kiss, and they, like, she talks about, like, how you need people around you. But it's not actually, like, this is the love of my life, and we've been together 10 years. Like, it's not explicit, so I wonder whether they just have.
There's a hole in this, and it's a problem, and it gets me. So I said about Woody Harrelson and Emilia Clarke both being given the worst lines in the movie to carry.
Yeah.
Woody Harrelson unfortunately has to die on the line, "I'll never get to play the space harp."
Oh yeah, I know. What the fuck is that?
And this is and this is what I mean by the cast in an autopilot. It's such a flub because it's a joke. It's a callback. Early in the film, he says, you know, we're going to here's an alternative version of this for you, right? He wants to retire to Glee Ensemble and play the harpsichord.
Yeah.
If that is just a bullshit thing he says to keep his crew going along and to maintain a persona, which is something all those characters are doing.
To flirt with his girlfriend or whatever. Yeah.
To kind of assure them this is one last job. You know, there's a repeated motif with Beckett where, like, at the end he says, like, oh, actually, this thing for Jabba the Hutt, that's my last job.
Yeah.
You know, this was my last job, or was that one my last job?
Mm. Yeah.
Like, you know, if he's just a prime bullshitter,
fine.
That makes works.
Sense. It's a quip.
Even it's such a dumb thing to want to do that, you know, and Rio calls him on it, like, you're tone deaf, you're not going to do that. Like, that it would be fine if that was a complete fabrication. Like, it's something he's saying to maintain a persona or to convince Han that he's a different type of person than he actually is, whatever. The fact that his dying words.
They should have let into it. It should have been silly. It should have been, "I'll never be a pastry chef." It should have been something really...
Like, "Play the space harp at my space funeral, Han." It reveals that was genuine, I think, unless he decided to do a big goof for his last moment.
And it's weird considering that, like, there's already a, like, slightly lampshady, but, like, good gag, you know, when he's in, like, shooting, and the X-Wings, TIE fighters are after them, and Han says, like, "On the honors," and there's, like, two rounds of space metaphor.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that worked for me. Like, that was funny to me.
That was
like,
good,
"Are they honors?" So they've already joked about, like, people being, like, suddenly folksy and, you know, space folksy when they're never space folksy. So for him to die, like, ultimate space folksy, like, "I just wish I played the space harmonica more."
Exactly. I say that partly to make fun of that line, but also because it means that stuff with Val and crew was genuine.
I did read it as him, like, I read it as him, like, bitterly repeating his running joke. That's how I read it. But, like, it doesn't make a lot of character sense.
For me, I didn't
read it as, like, "I'm literally really fucking love the xylophone."
Yeah, exactly. You don't believe how much I fucking love the xylophone. Play me out.
Do you know how much a xylophone is? 2 credits. I was going to buy 7 million xylophones.
Exactly. It comes so soon after the word was smile at the end of the film.
Right, yeah.
That it's too close to get the benefit of the doubt like that for me.
When I thought about having adventures with you, it always made me... You know what I was going to say? The word I was going to say was xylophone. That doesn't even obey the sense. That doesn't even obey grammar.
Exactly.
I always wanted to xylophone. Yeah, second draft, maybe.
just
polish that up.
That's what I mean. Like, those little gaps in the script.
But I think, yeah.
Like, air holes, yeah.
Yeah, none of this tanked it for me. None of this was, like, distracting for me. None of it, like, I know that we're maybe being more critical than we were The Last Jedi, but I think that just reflects the fact that it's a less ambitious movie, and I think it achieved what it wanted to do really well, is how I'd, like, generally characterize
it. And there's totally, like, you know, maybe we've done character stuff, like, there are moments in it that are just, like, really good fun and sort of well-directed action and sort of little things that's easy to kind of get lost in when we're talking about the deeper meanings of some of the characters and things.
And I will say that for me, even as a discrete film, it hangs together better than a lot of the Marvel movies do for me. Genuinely, I experience this as like a fun, like, heist summer blockbuster movie that totally works on its own terms and has... And for me, it did have, like, character arcs that make sense. I'm not saying they're, like, the greatest in the world, but, like, it made more sense as a discrete movie than a lot of movies in the sort of, like, grander Disney machine.
Yeah. I think I don't know how you feel about this, but its use of music specifically has times when it's really good, and there are bits of music I really like. Like, I really like the how unusual the Marauder Emphis Nest music
is. Yes. Apparently that's like, it's a Bulgarian like, or something? Yeah, I say to the end of the credits the first time and I saw something like that.
It reminds me a lot, for some reason, of the Akira soundtrack.
That's a good point, yeah.
Like, and it's so different. Yeah. And it very effectively, for me, sets up, like, there are different kinds of hero's theme in Star Wars. You haven't heard them all yet.
Yeah.
But speaking of hero's themes, you also get It Can't Resist quotation, musical quotation from the other movies. In some of the most... Like, so there's part of me that... So this is... Maybe this is our way into talking about the plot of this movie, and then... But let's finally break the seal, because we've been talking for more than an hour.
Yeah, we said we were going to make this shorter than the last one, but...
How it relates to the universe, right?
Yeah.
And for me, the musical cues are sort of... Absolute, like, it's in full wink mode for much of it. Like, when they are leaving Kessel and the Star Destroyer looming out of the cloud, basically, in the Imperial blockade, beautiful image.
Yeah.
Immediately cuts in to a little bit of the Death Star theme from
New
Hope. Yeah,
that one isn't necessary. That's not necessary.
Yeah, and then bits of the Death Star escape theme cut in during that chase sequence, which is the same track they use, I think, beautifully, effectively in The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
Where, like, in The Last Jedi, the only bit of original, and they actually don't even redo it, it's not even using a motif, they use the actual original John Williams recording of that piece of music for the bit where Chewie and the Falcon draws the TIE fighters away from the battle on Crait in The Last Jedi. And it's, I think, beautifully done, because it's a moment of pure nostalgia, but because it's a moment of pure nostalgia in that moment, in that movie, it draws your attention to how much has been lost.
Yeah.
It's just Chewie flying the Falcon now.
Yeah.
And it's fucking full of porgs.
Yeah.
And, like, so things have, you know, remember this moment is there in service of a look at what we've lost or look at what we've changed. And it also has a bittersweet relationship with what The Last Jedi does to set up your relationship with heroism in the Star Wars universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film that wants to complicate your relationship with the past. So it gives you this, it indulges you with a moment of like pure original trilogy Star Wars for a bit.
Yeah.
And then goes back to it. And I think it's really nice. Whereas in Solo... The same trick is essentially just like, here we go, boys and girls, it's Millennium Falcon time.
But the Millennium Falcon, I think, is the important part of that sentence, which also is a great sentence we should say all the time. But because it's, for me, it feels cheap when it seems to be just, hey, the Empire, remember the Death Star, or don't remember the Death Star hasn't happened yet. But I do think it's earned all to acknowledge that, that Chewie and Han flying the Falcon is for the first time together is a moment that like breathes the original trilogy. Right. And so I think, so I think that angle of it, so literally, even like literally on a camera angle level, when it's pointed at them in the cockpit and it's the first time ever, like in a way, it's almost less meta than it, like the swell when, you know, when you see Rey in the Falcon in The Force Awakens. I know it's not, you know, precisely the same, it's not quoting the score in the same way, but it's doing the same, like, hey, look at this ship. So we have another, hey, look, it's the Falcon in this movie. And in a way, it's even, again, this is going to get to a conversation about the difference between, like, character truth and the narrative versus what these are as films. So it's, on a film level, it's totally earned in The Force Awakens, because on a film level, you know, the Falcon is such a big deal and the audience is seeing it again for the first time in forever. But on like a character level, acknowledging what it means for, so the moment, when Han sees the Falcon for the first time, and then the moment when Han and Chewie are flying it together for the first time, that's like, you know, in this universe, history making stuff. And I think it's fair to acknowledge it. But you're right, like that shot when you see the Imperial blockade and like the Death Star stuff kicks in seems just to be telling you like the Empire, we've seen them, like the Death Star, and like, that's not the part that's significant.
So
to me.
The other part, like, and this is what I mean, it's like it's such a like that stuff is so you know, this is something. Yeah, I think you're right to draw attention to The Force Awakens. Something The Force Awakens does as well. It's this feeling of like, here's the Star Wars you expect, I think.
Yeah.
And the for me, the nadir of this in the film, maybe let's talk about this as its own thing. Darth Maul.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When Maul appears, They not only play a bit of Duel of the Fates.
Yeah, I noticed that.
It's that happening as
it's Matt, lost my leg theme.
As he draws his lightsaber to him for no reason.
No reason. Just to make sure that a lightsaber's been ignited in every movie.
Yep. And also because I'd actually, if you don't, I don't know, maybe it's a bit of a left turn if you had something else to say about the rest of it, but so I have mixed feelings about Darth Maul in this film. Because actually it wasn't such a surprise. Because if you know, the vast majority of cinema goers will not have watched all of the Clone Wars and Rebels TV shows. If you have, then Darth Maul being in this place at this time doing this is not a surprise.
Yeah.
But that is almost a bit of a problem with it, because so in the I'm not gonna spoil Rebels, but like in the Clone Wars, it's revealed Darth Maul survives his encounter with Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah.
And I mean, people have different opinions. He does get chopped in half and fall in a very spider big legs. Hole. And he has spider legs in the Clone Wars, which is a bit weird. But he's his survival is actually I think one of the few things worth rescuing from Phantom Menace. Like almost him dying in the Phantom Menace was a mistake at the time, because it's like, you know, there's very little worth salvaging from that film. At all, and one of the only things worth salvaging about it is that Darth Maul was always a really good image.
Yeah.
And the very few bits of effective atmospheric filmmaking in that movie all centre on Maul, including not just Duel of the Fates, the bit where he just sort of attacks them in the desert is still, like, really evocative of, like, what the fuck is this guy? Like, you know, what it's like to be Jedi attacked by a Sith for the first time in generations, like, that kind of thing. There's lots about Maul that could have been done, and Sam Witwer, who plays him in the cartoons and is the voice now, does an amazing job with that character. In the Clone Wars, he basically takes over the criminal underworld and forms something called the Shadow Collective, basically to get his revenge on both the nascent Empire and the Jedi. Like, both the Sith and the Jedi. He's neither. He hates both of them. He was left to dead by the Sith and chopped in half by a Jedi. So, you know, there's all of that stuff. And he has his arc continues in Star Wars Rebels. It's a minor spoiler for Star Wars Rebels. It's a really beautifully handled arc that is really, really well done. And begins, you know, 10 years after this movie. So his presence is a big shock for a lot of people. That will require some explaining of the, I thought he was dead. Hang on, no, robot legs variety.
Yeah.
But for people who know a lot, it's only the midpoint of the story where you know the rest of it almost in its entirety. So.
And you've missed out, like, column C, which is, like I mentioned this to you, like, Kim Newman, who's a great film critic, but his review starts with, like, the film takes place before Phantom Menace.
Nope.
Obviously, people who are judging this as a film have no responsibility to, like, engage with, you know, EU stuff. They don't, like, because, like, they're judging it as a movie. That's totally fine. But, like, apparently that threw people. And so, like, it does exist in this weird... It did get the biggest reaction in both showings I've been to. And not just, like, what? But, like, woo! You know, like, people were into it. And, like, the first showing I went, people reacted as soon as you heard the voice. And then, like, and again, when you saw the face, that's a weird way of saying it. It's fine for me. Like, it's like, cause, like, I was aware from, like, I'm not too far into Rebels, but, like, I've watched a bit of Rebels and I've watched a bit of Clone Wars, and, like, it wasn't, like, a shock apart from on a, like, oh, okay, so they're going with this kind of level. It wasn't like a boop, you know, so I was actually surprised that it got, like, gasps. Because in a way, that does show, like, a level of engagement. Because there's a lot of people that have only seen The Phantom Menace once and won't even remember they died, honestly. Genuinely. Like, I think that will be a subset of the audience.
Yeah.
One thing I will say about it is, with the exception of the, like, slightly unnecessary, like, intimidation lightsaber faffing about, I don't think it, like, was lent on to give the movie a sense of culmination. You know what I mean? I don't think it was lent on as, like, this is, like, the big deal.
Yeah.
It was incidental in a way, which is good.
And, you know, I do like the, do you know who, you know...
Dryden Vos works for.
It was not a total surprise to me, because Dryden Vos has a Sith holocron in his office surrounded by lightsabers. So there's an element of, like...
There were some hints.
there were some hints. But, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about this afterwards. It would have been almost more meaningful to me if it had been a younger Snoke.
Yeah, mate. I suppose the only thing I would worry was that it would reignite the, like, Snoke Wars.
Yeah, that's true. The reason I suggest that is simply because it would give a bit of texture to a character who... I like that his journey is to not be tremendously important.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm trying to avoid...
So it's basically... do you want someone who's already been sliced in half, or do you want someone who will be sliced in half? Take your pick.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe I don't totally mean that. I guess what I'm saying is... I find it a little bit distracting, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is because I'm too mindful of other people's responses to it. But also, like, because... So, I'm trying to avoid... What I'm trying to avoid, really, is talking too much about Rebels.
Oh, yeah, fair. Yeah.
But, So, they know what to, they know what they're doing with the Maul character. And they know where that character's going.
Mm-hmm.
And if you... watch Rebels, you know where that character's going.
Yeah.
So this is a... It's like a trivia point more than a reveal, if that makes sense. Yeah. It's like, oh, he happened to be here at this point in time. And it's a very logical place for him to be.
But that's an assumption, I think. I don't think that's how a typical audience would read it.
Yeah.
Because I think an audience reads it. Even an audience that's like... I think there's going to be people in the audience who... just like recognize Darth Maul. There'll be people who will be like, oh, he's not dead. And there'll be people who are like vaguely, like, I'm slightly more than this, but only slightly, are, you know, aware that he's continued in Rebels and Clone Wars, but, you know, aren't like invested in it. I don't think it necessarily tells you this beat precisely aligns with where this is going in Rebels and Clone Wars. I think it just tells you that they are using some of it. It doesn't necessarily tell you they're using all of, you know what I mean? I don't think it necessarily anchors.
I mean, so he had like, I guess what I mean is, like, normally when something like this happens in a movie, it's a gesture, like, this is a story you haven't been told yet.
Yeah.
Like, this, you know, they might not make the Maul and Kira show movie, yeah. But it sort of suggests, like, what if they did?
Yeah.
But because of what audiences know from Rebels already...
Some audiences, yeah.
Well, you know, like, not insubstantial, like, it's a popular show, it's canonical Star Wars material. Not that people should be expected to know it, necessarily.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, if I walked out of the cinema with somebody who was like, you know, I'm making up a Star Wars fan here, but someone who just watched the movies but was like, oh my god, I didn't realize Maul was still alive. I wonder what's going to happen next. I could turn to them, and if I wasn't worried about spoilers, tell them exactly what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
And where it's going. And that, for me, takes away some of its power as a suggestive that's reveal, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I guess I'm just not assuming that they would necessarily do exactly the same. But yeah, that's fair.
Well, they've established that Rebels is canon. Like, it's... like,
but
lightsaber in Rogue One is his lightsaber from Rebels. Like,
well, I suppose for me that brings us on to, like, the industrial stuff, because I think... the status of canon is an interesting thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Because... I think for me, Star Wars, and we talked about this a bit with The Last Jedi. We talked about this before when we said, like, what it means to watch a new Star Wars movie. Explicitly, we're talking about the episodes, and we've all intuitively understood that there's something different about the episodes than the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that speaks to the kind of weird nature of Star Wars as something that is simultaneously totally synonymous with... it's treated as, like, a straightforwardly, like, a cultural behemoth. That, like, it was an event. Like, if you were alive in the 70s and 80s, you remember where you were when. You know what I mean? It's treated as, like, this huge, undeniable, or at least the episodes are, treated as this normal, undeniable cultural touchstone. At the same time as it's also very typical to be completely unaware of extended universe stuff, or to treat it as frivolous, or to treat it as for kids, or whatever, or not canon, you know. And so the status of canon becomes related to industrial kind of questions.
Yeah.
Because part of the sense that that the episodes should be read a certain way doesn't simply come from, like, the themes or the fact that they have these episode numbers from it. It comes from that they're bestowed on this, like, a new Star Wars movie is happening, and that's part of the news. Like, it was in the news, and it's it's our, ironically, considering, like, the enemy in Star Wars is, like, the evil empire. Part of what gives it the and this isn't necessarily a criticism, but the sheen of importance is to do with how much money it costs and how many eyes look at it. And so the stories exist in a weird space, because especially now Solo is being talked about as underperforming. If it does underperform, depending on what kind of, you know, industry metrics you're using for it, that's the first time a Star Wars movie's ever done that. But it doesn't feel like it because people aren't reading it the same way. And so part of our relationship with whether it's a big moment or not weirdly is a money thing. It's an industry thing. You know, there's weird things going on about what you read. And so I think this, and so just in that context, what canon is interesting, because part of that decision, I think, is also the audience's decision as what for a mainstream audience is Star Wars. And I think that's, like, I'm trying to think of like an analogy. Like, there's a reason people, not everyone, obviously, because a lot of people will just casually go to the Star Wars movie because it's fun. But there's a reason a lot of people would go to a midnight screening of an episode and not necessarily Solo or Rogue One.
Yeah.
And like, it's, and that's to do with how in like the sort of like entertainment media landscape we're in, those movies get treated as, this is what Star Wars is now. In a way that I think the stories will end up existing either in parallel to, or their existence will start to, or will start to soften that role of the episodes. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just like, it's just that juggle of what is this thing? Cause it's simultaneously something that everyone's nan knows and is like talked about like Thriller. And on the other hand, it's this incredibly niche thing that, oh, it's funny you watch that cartoon. Like, I've had people say, like, oh, when I've mentioned, like, Star Wars cartoons, that like, the thing is, like, funny you watch it. Like, how can it be both those two things at once?
Yeah.
And it's almost like, a new episode, I mean, obviously, like, people's mileage will vary on this, and there's a lot of people who won't give a shit about this the way I do, but fuck it. A new Star Wars episode is like a Beyonce album, and you're like, ah, this is what pop music means right now, and this is like what it expresses. And a good Solo, like a good stories movie, it's a Carly Rae Jepsen thing where you're like, ah, this is done in a, this is like very like, this light frothy thing has been done with expert attention, but is, you know, like, isn't gonna dominate how we talk about like womanhood or blackness for the next 4 years. So like, that is a weird analogy,
but no, that's where my brain,
do you know what I mean? And so like, so that's why I think the sort of, the blockbuster nature of Star Wars is not unimportant, because part of us takes this seriously because it's a big deal. It's like, did you, like, everyone knows where they were when, you know, and like this, these movies are starting to trouble that because they are on one hand indistinguishable. They're movies. They're made by LucasArts. They're Lucasfilm, you know, why are they different? But they are. And that's the thing that has to be figured out, I think.
What's really interesting from that point of view is, because I agree with you, however, this is, and actually it's not even a however, it's to kind of expand on that, but maybe with a bit of context, because one of the ways you and I come at it differently is I'm a wash in the old expansion.
Absolutely,
Like, so both of the stories movies have felt more embedded in the surrounding material. So the Ghost and Chopper from Rebels show up in Rogue One. The Kyber crystals that are a minor plot point on Jeddah are from the expanded universe, and specifically from the Clone Wars cartoon series. And then in Solo is extraordinary to watch, I think, after The Last Jedi, because it's insanely detailed from a old, not just current expanded universe stuff like the cartoons, but old school, you know, the stuff that they put to one side and put so much. Like,
In Voss's, like, chambers, there's like...
Yeah, like, there's a big crystal skull, which is probably, it's not just a cute reference to Indiana Jones and the crystal skull. Yeah. There's a Han Solo novel that has that crystal skull right on the front cover of it. Like, and that's one of the old school 70s Han Solo novels. Like, it's covered in this stuff. There's, I could, you know, go into so much, like, the Pike Syndicate who run Kessel. They are villains from the Clone Wars cartoon, and that was those costumes are based on CGI designs, and they had to kind of figure out a way of making them look good in real life with real practical effects. When Kira takes out that mine boss guy, and L3 says, "What was that?" She says, "That was Teras Kazi." The fighting style they use when she fights Strident Voss, that is from a PlayStation era Star Wars fighting game called Masters of Teras Kazi, which was created so that there could be a Tekken game, basically, that had Star Wars in it. And that then became the kind of martial arts of the Star Wars universe and the old expanded universe. The fact they fight with vibroblades and vibroswords, all of this stuff, like, it's steeped in it. Like, when Lando says to Beckett, you know, oh, you're Tobias Beckett, you killed Aura Singh.
Yeah.
Aura Singh is the bounty hunter who watches part of the pod race in Phantom Menace. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's steeped in this stuff. Sorry, go on.
No, I'm just saying that, like, I guess what I'm saying is we aren't at a point yet where it's clear what that, whether that's evocation and Easter eggs and attention and wanting to live in the world and give fans the thrill of like seeing it and making the world seem real, or whether that is, you know what I mean? It's at the moment, I think we're still in a position where the films bestow canonicity upon what they do. Whether that's new or whether that's something that's existed in an external, in an expanded universe thing, the act of them being in a film is that which makes it canon. Doesn't matter if it's been formalized, it's been offered its canonicity in a different way before. I think at the moment the film is still seen, but that's loosening because the films are becoming less like behemoths.
Yeah.
So with the way it's going to go is unclear whether it does go to like, it exists in a kind of Marvel position where Star Wars is straightforwardly treated as a kind of, not straightforwardly, but becomes a kind of complex media franchise that has different component parts, or whether it remains a film series that has other things attached to it. And it's not clear which one that is right now, I would still say.
I would say I don't fully agree, actually. So the reason I would say that is I think the stuff that Dave Filoni did on Clone Wars and Rebels is held in very high regard at Lucasfilm. Like, they are kind of consistently given, like, a lot of leeway to do quite brave things with that series. Mm-hmm. And one thing, there's two parts to this, basically. First part is these movies are packed with references to Rebels specifically.
Yeah, I'm not denying that.
But I'm making a point about that specifically. So what I'm saying is, and I don't think that's about the movies canonizing Rebels so much as I think that is an act of coherent universe management on the part of Lucasfilm. And there's a few specific things, because I've encountered this in a very minor form recently. So, you know, the link I would make is, so when Han sits down and lies to Lando about what his ship is in Solo, he says, I have a VCX-100, and everyone goes, oh, that's a great ship. That's the Ghost from Rebels.
Yeah.
So there's like lots of little things like that. Rebels finished a couple of months ago, and it ends on stuff that has quite big connotations for that universe, and all the way through to the new trilogy, actually. And I know from the way that Lucasfilm work and the Lucasfilm story groups work that what they tend to do is put out like an interpretation of the universe or a kind of a plot beat that is then pervasive across all forms of Star Wars media.
Mm-hmm.
And so a big part of that currently is that the Force has a will. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, I've encountered this in a very small way, writing scripts for a promo series for a Star Wars official licensed game. Mm-hmm. Like, those kinds of, like, this is what Star Wars means right now, and this is what it means, is actually, to some extent, set centrally, not by the writers of the individual movies. And that's cross-media in terms of what's canon now.
Yeah.
However, this is to agree with you, that episodes, the main saga films, are the ones that, and this is what's great, I really like this, that those are the films that are actually almost given permission to break away from that and be radically different, which is really interesting. Like, so I would say that basically, like, I sort of, like, it's a similar point, but from a slightly different angle, in that I think there is a coherent multimedia attempt to tell a particular story with Star Wars that spans things. And where the movies are actually not more important. They are financially, but like the movies are having to obey some of the same rules as books and games and comics and TV shows.
Yeah.
However, it is those flagship episodes 7, 8, 9s that are the ones being given the license to be braver and stranger and more challenging.
Yeah.
Which is good. That is the right way around.
Yeah, I agree.
So the way I perceive it is that those main series movies are like the sort of tip of the spear, kind of like, you're right, the Beyonce albums.
But that was a weird analogy.
Is a more coherent industrial apparatus than you might think building the Legion of Jepsons.
But I guess what I would say is that that's excellent, by the way. The Jeffsons, a 60s TV show.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say that what I would say is that that's still, which is funny. This is such a weird point to make about a discussion about canonicity, to sort of say that audience versus author. But those are all decisions. A lot of what you were talking about then were, and again, totally do gesture towards the intention to build a diverse media landscape that has lots of different forms but is in the same universe. That is analogous to something like Marvel, which obviously like is by its nature now like intensely like multi-generic. Mm. I guess what I would not necessarily push back on, because fans who are really embedded in the extended universe are not like, they're not, they shouldn't be dismissed at all. But I guess what I'm talking about is like where this exists in like the general public imagination is still can't be decided by a piece of fine print in a Lucasfilm franchising deal. You know what I mean? Like they don't necessarily have control of like what is taken. So I guess it's an interesting issue, and I think it just speaks to like how, you know, 20th and 21st century entertainment has evolved to have these kind of universes, and how we respond to what about them is impressive. And I do think that part of the experience of watching Star Wars is like metatextual in that sense, that it's to do with its cultural power. It's to do with its grandiosity. And that's why I totally agree. It's interesting that it's the, and obviously controversial, but it's interesting that it's the episodes that are taking the bold risks. Or specifically The Last Jedi, honestly. And this comes to the heart of the big, so much of this comes to the heart of like the status of The Last Jedi. And I also think that, like, they hold the one of the reasons they inspire awe is they are, as much as Solo can, something like Solo can do lots of really beautiful and thoughtful acts of world building in the sense of, like, fleshing out, and whether that's to do with, you know, relating to things like Rebels as well, and also, like, physically creating and putting on screen, it's the episodes that are tasked with, like, creation. This is becoming very religious, but, like, in the same way that A New Hope didn't just create the Star Wars universe, but it created a genre of cinema, it changed cinema, like, it created so much. It's that like, weight of, like, cultural creation is still put on the episode movies. Mm. And people may or may not be, like, I bet there'll be loads of people, like, that say, like, this is not, I'm not conscious of this at all, this is totally not how I think about it. But I think that is part of how we think about the experience of a new Star Wars. In the same way that, like, if well, not quite the same way, but it would be a new story if J.K. Rowling were writing a new novel of Harry Potter, despite the fact that one would think a film is a big thing. The Fantastic Beasts movies aren't taking up a big space in our imagination. The form is still important, and it would genuinely be a new story if there was a new novel. And so I just think audiences, like, emotional relationships to, like, form and canon and the sense of, like, cultural centrality are just really weird and complicated and affect how we view these things.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's funny, like, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, it's been funny. I did what I do, which is go on the Star Wars subreddit to gauge the audience reaction. And that
seemed pretty positive, right, to this?
Enormously positive.
Yeah.
So this is fascinating. A lot of it is,
yeah.
And so, so you had the backlash. So there was a big backlash against this movie.
Yeah.
Which was largely fueled by The Last Jedi. So it was, you know, Disney's garbage, so this is going to be garbage. I can't believe this man doesn't look anything like Harrison Ford, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now that the movie has been proven to be, and, you know, we've talked about all the things we like and don't like about it. I think there are things that are brave about it. I think there are things that are tremendously safe about it.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very different movie to The Last Jedi. It is slavish in its dedication, to the types of detail that fans want to see. To the extent that there's almost no risk in the movie, right? Like, you know that Han is going to do the Kessel Run in between 12 and 14 seconds.
Rounding up or down.
And you know, the bit where, you know, the film does not need the line where Lando says, nobody does the Kessel Run in less than 20 parsecs.
Right, yeah.
It really doesn't need him to say that. You know, it succeeds because the performances are strong, the set pieces are strong, the production design is brilliant. And so it's a really lovely place to occupy and a very fun place to be for the 2 hours and a bit that you spend there. What it doesn't do is really challenge much at all about those characters or what kinds of experiences you should expect from them. And, you know, it does feel like watching a bunch of sort of watching a bunch of internal expectations resolve themselves, right?
Yeah.
Like, you knew this was going to be about the Kessel Run. You know what I mean? Like, you knew it was going to meet Chewie for the first time, probably. Like,
yeah.
You know, all this stuff. And that, all of that is encapsulated in the moment in The Last Jedi where Luke says to Rey, what did you think was going to happen? Do you think I was just going to walk out in front of the
fuck, I love The Last Jedi.
Yeah. And it's
fuck, I love The Last Jedi.
Because The Last Jedi is brave enough to say to its fans, this is not what you expect, and we're not going to apologize for that.
Yeah.
And then, but Luke is wrong. Luke is arrogant. There are things about Luke that aren't quite right. And it has a sweet, you know what I mean? Like, people that really don't like The Last Jedi have interpreted it as this outward, complete fuck you, right? But it's not. It's so much more complicated than that. And there's so much more going on. Like, there's a anxiety in the relationship between Kylo Ren and Rey that just absolutely is not present between any character in Solo, right?
Yeah.
Like, in terms of what either of them even want.
Yeah. Like,
you know, it has, and it's actually rare among Star Wars movies for that reason. And very unique among Star Wars movies for that reason. And that's great, but it's really interesting to me because I don't know whether to be worried or not that, so The Last Jedi obviously made a lot of money, but is very mixed in the public eye.
Yeah.
Solo, by early accounts, is underperforming. God knows if that's due to the weekend it came out or whatever. Yeah. God knows how it'll do eventually. It'll probably be fine.
Yeah, like, it'll make its money back, certainly, but it might get culturally interpreted as, like, not doing well.
Yeah, but critically lukewarm.
Yeah, which surprised me, because I didn't think it was a bad movie at all. I was quite surprised that there was any, like,
But actually, I wonder if that's partly because critics, you know, were given something to chew on with The Last Jedi, really. Like, you know what I mean? It is very safe. Like, if I didn't, I think I would enjoy it if it wasn't a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be mind blowing.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
although I have, I mean, again,
slightly north of Jupiter Ascending. A movie I like a lot.
No, I would say, I think I like Jupiter Ascending a lot, and this movie did need a B man. I do think it's a better put together film than that, and I think I would enjoy it. I don't want to lean on this too much because this is also the classic Phantom Menace defense, but like, there were kids in the theatre the first time I saw it that fucking loved it. Although the weirdest interaction was a kid in the foyer going in who said, who is Han Solo? And his mum responded bafflingly, well, not bafflingly, but just, I want to know what this kid knows that this makes sense as an answer, Luke Skywalker's friend. And like, that is a weird, like, I want to know, like, what exactly that kid knows about Star Wars, that they needed to be reminded who Han Solo was. But anyway, I just want to talk to this kid.
Yeah.
But, and it was because that's like a very 70s way of explaining Han Solo. It's like, Luke Skywalker's friend.
Yeah, good pal.
Yeah, exactly. I wandered off. This movie really did seem to be working for, my first audience was a kind of like mixture of like lots of fans, also like some families. Today was all of the single people in New York City. There was like no one sitting next to anyone else.
It's like that at mine today as well, usually. Yeah.
It was quite nice in a weird way because it meant like the chuckles and the laughter was like, oh, we're all friends.
Yeah.
Those of us who went to a noon showing of Solo.
It's been quite muted both times I've seen it, apart from confused muttering when Darth Maul shows up.
Oh, okay. I've had like, maybe it's an American thing, but like there was a lot of laughter in both, and a couple of like, there was obviously someone behind me who was getting a lot of the reference, like who like went like, yes, I like Bossk. Like, it's just like the little references was like enjoying.
Yeah.
So it was like a mixture of that. The first screening was slightly more dad heavy, which I could only pick up on because of the thoroughly like delighted response to the Bohemian Rhapsody movie, which could only describe as a relentless dad energy.
Yeah.
It's like Mamma Mia for dads.
That is what that is.
I was really like, I was a bit nervous about my audience because there was like, the Mamma Mia for dads was fine, but there was also like a really troubling undercurrent of misogyny in the response to the, have you seen the trailer for the movie Adrift?
No.
Let's not wander off too much, but it's about a couple who are on a boat and who are sailing around the world, and there's like a huge storm, and like it's left to the girl to like try and figure things out, and there's a lot of like casual women driver muttering, and I was like, oh god, I'm gonna watch a Star Wars with these people, but they turned out to just be like a few people. Anyway, dad energy. What was my point? That was,
see, cause
that it worked for both, it worked for very different audiences both times I've seen it.
I think it, so for me, something that I found quite telling is I've seen a couple of people in my sort of social media sphere, not necessarily like people who necessarily share lots in common with Star Wars, be like, oh my god, Han Solo is Lucasfilm's apology for The Last Jedi. And I've seen that attitude in a few different places. It's all over Reddit. It's
such a weird way to understand filmmaking.
It is. But it's also clearly not the film they were trying to make. You know, I think it is a more conservative movie. I think, you know, Kasdan's script has a lot of obvious scriptmanship in it. In it, not just the I never get to play harpsichord or the smile line or anything like that, but you know, it's
yeah, there's a lot of set, like a lot of like walking into a room and saying what you're there for.
But there's good moments as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But you know, compared to The Last Jedi, it's just not in the same league. And so that it is an accidentally very conservative movie, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It doesn't want to be, but the environment it is entered,
yeah,
is it is primed to look like the steady hand at the wheel conservative alternative to freewheeling Ryan and his and his undermining tendencies. And so, like, that I think is almost a shame for the movie, but that's why it's so weird to me that it is under, let's find out, but not underperforming critically and commercially. Because I almost, like, I don't wish ill on it, but I basically really don't want it to, I don't think it will change the way the ship is steered.
Yeah.
In terms of the episode movies. Episode 9 is a bit of a question mark for me, because...
But, like, the potential of Rian Johnson's new trilogy, I think, is the thing that you're like, And also, I'm the same. Like, I don't know how much, like, steering there will be based... Like, I'm totally excited for episode, like, the next one, but, like... there could be like a little bit of what be perceived as course correction.
If JJ like hits the panic button, and like there's a nightmare scenario in my mind where JJ Abrams smacks the audience fear button,
and Ray has 8 parents, all of them more exciting.
It's just they're
than
all
left.
Parents. It's everywhere.
My mum is Enfys Nest. My dad was a Death Star.
Exactly. Like, that's why I'm a ball in a hat. BB-8. There's
the Death Star only laid 2 eggs.
That's actually a joke nicked from that webcomic about R2-D2 shagging the Death Star with his little pokey thing. But I nicked it. So don't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you don't worry. You worry. but yeah, there's like it's a strange environment. Like, I have to admit, I don't really care about the Boba Fett movie.
No, me neither. I'm glad I got to see some Mandalorian armor.
Yeah. Like, partly because, like...
Who is the director? I've just forgotten. Oh, it's someone I like, I think.
It is someone relatively good.
It's someone I like. Now to remember who I like. I've Wikipedia'd Boba Fett. It's James Mangold. Okay.
Yes.
So, like, and it depends which James Mangold you get. Because, like... If you view him through the lens of Logan, you see him as someone who takes what is ostensibly a Disney, and is still technically a Disney movie, but does something generically super different with it, which in theory could work really well. On the other hand, you know, like, maybe he'll turn it into a musical about the early years of Johnny Cash. We just can't say. to me, like, there's like also like a safe pair of hands. Like, it could, like, but again, also, I feel like if you were going to do the Logan move, there are more interesting... Boba Fett's obviously an interesting character, just it feels like the moment has maybe passed.
But I'll stop you there. Is he? And I say this as a Star Wars mega fan. What does Boba Fett fucking do?
Falls into a sarlacc.
He falls down a big hole. He says, he's got a cool hat. Well, he says, he's no good to be dead. And then later, Tamara Morrison will repeat him saying, he's no good to be dead. Like,
he's invested in the quality of... refrigeration.
So there'll be a bit, I'll guarantee you this now, there'll be a bit in the Boba Fett movie where he disintegrates somebody and gets a reputation for doing that. And then when
he will also say he's no good to me alive.
Yeah. And then he'll disintegrate somebody. He's going to say that line. And then Darth Vader will say to him, no disintegrations in Empire Strikes Back. And he'll go, oh, that's where that's from. Like, yeah. For me, like, obviously a character with a rich life in the expanded universe, and I'm not discrediting that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Some of his Mandalorian cred has been, I think, snatched out from under him by Rebels, basically, which introduces, like, actual families full of more useful Mandalorians than Boba Fett is. And also, we have the unfortunate memory of young Boba Fett sitting in his dad's ride, laughing at Obi-Wan Kenobi. So it's quite hard to, like, I was thinking about this. You know, in the original script for Revenge of the Sith, Han Solo was in it as a young man.
I didn't know that.
So originally there was going to be a scene where a little boy runs, and this is not a joke, a little boy runs into set and gives Yoda, who's on Kashyyyk at the time, the Wookiee homeworld, and says, "Master Yoda, the droids are in the bin," or whatever. and Yoda would say, like, "Who are you?" And he would go, "I'm Han Solo," and then just leave. And so that was originally going to happen in that movie. If that had happened, they could still have made Solo a Star Wars story. But a little part of you would always be like,
"Do you remember that time you ran up to Yoda?" Yeah.
And I think Boba Fett movie has that problem a little bit.
Yeah, and it's and then on, like, an industry level, it seems to be repeating the, like, Marvel thing of, like, how many fucking years did it take to get to Captain Marvel?
Right.
You know, so it's yeah.
We've definitely started talking about Solo at this point.
We have, I guess, but I think it's because this is, like, an interest. This is like a specific moment in what Star Wars is that will be further complicated by things like the, I forgot the name of the Game of Thrones creators, but their TV show will complicate. Is it a TV show or is it a movie they're doing?
It's a TV.
Like, that will complicate it, because that then brings in all the different expectations people have about animated television versus, like, quote unquote prestige television. Like, there are so many moments in over the next few years in which what Star Wars is will shift, and I guess this moment is, like, it's just sits at, like, an interesting point of it where we don't really know. And, like, it's one thing I would say about it being conservative is, like, and not to bang this drum too much, there's a weird way in which it's conservative is at least resistant to the conservativeness is at least slightly resistant to the broader Disney machine, in that it's a it's not as much as a heist movie. It's not really a heist movie, so I can't say it's a genre piece in that sense. But it is a, like, lowered stakes action movie in a way that's unusual for Disney. Not so, like, which is a weird thing to say, because saying, like, having a controlled movie is rebellious is, like, a strange thing to say. But it's like more of an Ant-Man, maybe. You know what I mean? Like, although actually just seeing the new trailer in a way. Ant-Man has one thing up its sleeve that a lot of Marvel movies doesn't, which is that it's like filmmaking style is informed by the nature of the character, in the sense that it is a film that textually uses like physical comedy and like sight gags, because that's how his power works. And a lot of Marvel movies don't have that relationship between form and character. And this one kind of does in a way, but it's a slightly different point, but like, I love Marvel, but my beef is the lack of, you know, experimentation or, you know, and like repetitive movie going experiences. And there is something to be said for its controlledness, which would have been further amplified had it been a Lord and Miller comedy, and could have fallen on its flat face, but also would have been more daring.
Yeah, like there's an argument here. It's not dissimilar to, you know, I don't know if people know exactly what happened to Gareth Edwards on the set of Rogue One, but that movie got taken away from him kind of right at the end and turned into some whatever it is.
But not to the same extent. So to bring back Ant-Man again, because apparently my analogies are Beyonce and Ant-Man. This was an Edgar Wright situation, rather, you know, it was you've got like auteur-y directors and it doesn't work for Disney.
Yeah.
For all I know, like, they could have totally been making a mess of it. I don't know, but
there
just,
was a rumor
that's
that
how it read.
Really was a mess. Like, that they, you know, that was the thing I read, but what the truth of that is. Like, I wouldn't say that, like, Ron Howard is the obvious safe pair of hands choice for an action.
I think he did.
He did
a good job. Yeah. And the thing about Ron Howard is, like, he's not incapable of, like, big clunkers. And this is not an Angels and, you know, it's not a Da Vinci Code. You know what I mean? It's a really solid, and also not just boring. Like, there's moments that I think are really, like, playfully and nicely directed. Yeah. And I do think Paul Bettany's great in it. And that's, like, clearly a Ron Howard, Paul Bettany, like, relationship thing. to do a second Daniel Mallory Ortberg shout out. The video, which yes. I recommend everyone look up of his Paul Bettany impression, is especially exciting in this film because he's literally surrounded by the setting sun at all times, the 360 right, degrees yeah. in his yacht.
Yeah, I said that to you, didn't I? Yeah, that yeah, is, you did. Like, it's, yes. His
Paul Bettany Star Wars.
Yeah, apart from the fact that he doesn't get a dying line, which robs him, and Paul Bettany.
I also like the harpsichord.
Of the most Paul Bettany moment.
Yeah.
Which would be for him to say, like, well, I suppose it has to be like this, doesn't it? And then, yeah. you know, to fall over onto his fiber knife.
But I was very good at playing the harpsichord.
Exactly. Why does Woody Harrelson get the Paul Bettany final line?
Yeah.
No, Paul Bettany, it wouldn't be quite the same thing. It would be, there's no time to play the harpsichord now.
Timothy.
That would be the Bettany out, but he doesn't get it. Yes. What were we talking about?
We talked a lot about Star Wars. Do we have any? I love that Chewie ripped someone's arms off. Always there for that.
Yes. I like the I've got these arms gesture. That was good.
Yes. What other?
I feel like we should end on something kind of neat.
Ooh, okay. What's neat?
But no, but you're getting there. Like, you know, I feel like we've unpicked so much that's complicated about this movie.
Yeah, we have. I think it's because it's an interesting conversation, but it's slightly different from my experience of the movie, which was like, oh, I'm having a great fun time.
Yes,
which
exactly.
Which genuinely is the spirit of my experience of it. Other cool things. I enjoyed the movie. Well, Alden Ehrenreich's great. I know I said that at the beginning, but like hats off to him for a really like tough role that he handled really well. And I once saw him on the street and I wish he was my friend.
Yeah.
There we go.
But not the same way you wish Chewie was your friend.
No, absolutely in the same way. More powerfully, it's just more surprising with Chewie.
Okay, good.
I also do have boring interests.
Some of your desires are very conventional.
Right, exactly. there's a spectrum. There's the magnificent lesbianism of the Millennium Falcon on one hand, and yeah. there's the extraordinary heterosexuality of his last shirt.
You know, I'm disappointed in the internet's reactionaries that I haven't seen anyone accuse this sort of increasingly socially aware Star Wars, or a particularly increasingly socially aware Millennium Falcon, as being the Millennial Falcon, which seems like the lowest hanging fruit.
Oh, dang.
Gone for it. And if I were a right of centre YouTuber, I'd be all over that. Thank God I'm not, though, because then I'd have to go all the way in a bin. But so for yeah. me, like, because I appreciate it, we've talked over it so much, and I really enjoy picking over these movies like this, because you're right, they do stand as sort of these cultural kind of moments. For me, what was, I think, lovely for me is Star Wars has always been part of my life, a very important part of my life. Like, you know, it's a very sort of, it's a repeating imaginative touch tone for me, which I guess yeah. is what it means to be a fan of something. Yeah. The young Han Solo, this is going to be my, you know, you got Chewie. so the young Han Solo books were like one of the first like romance plots in a book I ever responded to. And I was like six or seven. But, yeah. like, he has his, like, girlfriend from home and that, and I've completely forgotten what her name is, the kind of Kira-equivalent character. They use a surprising amount of the beats from those stories in the movie. And so there are aspects of that that's sort of just a nostalgic thing. When I was a teenager, like, my start as a writer of anything, really, the first things I ever wrote that people said, this is good, you should write, was Star Wars fan fiction, basically.
Yeah.
And my Star Wars role-playing community online was all kind of criminal underworld stuff. And that was all rooted in things like Black Sun Syndicate and all of this stuff.
Yeah, I remember.
Which has been canonized by the Dave Filoni cartoons to some extent. Yeah. Black Sun is one of the five syndicates referenced in the movie with Crimson Dawn. But Crimson Dawn and its iconography is so Black Sun-ish, and like the yacht and everything else, the kind of sleek black and gold and all the rest of it. And like, so that stuff, it felt like seeing the enactment of a Star Wars that I feel like I lived in, you know, in a kind of community of other people who all sort of did the role playing in that environment. And now I'm more than a year into running regular Star Wars role playing, pen and paper role playing sessions with friends, and I really, really get a lot out of it. And so, you know, I've been sort of telling stories in my own sort of version of that universe with those friends, and there are things about the movie that really resonate with certain things.
Yeah.
There's a way Paul Bettany says the word party. Like, after he stabs somebody, that I know my friend Matt will resonate with because we had a weird moment that was eerily similar to that. And so there's all these things that are very, very personal about it. And that I genuinely love about it, and seeing Corellia like in that way,
yeah,
like even the yeah. you know, obviously like this is a strange thing, but that kind of like I always find like wet dockyards very evocative, and it's because
it's almost like we both grew up in Liverpool.
It is, yeah.
Like, when our mum worked on the docks,
yeah, exactly.
On the note of our mum working on the docks, I just remembered another thing that fell flat, which is a silly thing to say in the middle of us praising it, but like the line about my dad being laid off is too Bon Jovi. The word like
it's
like,
yes, it is. No, like, I actually had this feeling as well. There's some element of like he was just a small town boy.
It is, yeah, which I'm into. I like, but it's, yeah. Again, it's like equal rights in the phrase laid off. It's too 20th century. Sorry, carry on.
Right, you're right. Like, and so there's all this stuff that's really evocative and like pure childhood Star Wars for me from, you know, yeah. almost every stage of my life, Star Wars. It's teen yeah. Star Wars for me. It's adult yeah. Star Wars. And even things like that battle scene, the way that felt, I was like,
yeah.
you know, part of me, and that's to explain how I receive these movies. Part of me goes to these movies with a notepad running in my brain, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can borrow something from this, or this complicates it. And, but what has changed is The Last Jedi made me think much more critically about Star Wars and about mm-hmm. what I get out of Star Wars, about what Star Wars can be about.
Uh-huh.
And that makes something like Solo, as much as I appreciate it, I'll never have quite yeah. the response I might have had if that yeah. movie hadn't come along and asked the right questions. Like,
yeah.
it reminds me of like, because I think there's an attitude that fans can have where you can't bear criticism. Of the thing you love, and when that criticism comes from the thing you love, which is exactly what The Last Jedi is,
yeah.
it's, you know, they turn Luke into somebody who is critical of Star Wars,
yeah.
which for certain fans is, there is no betrayal greater than that.
Yeah.
It's a greater betrayal than the prequels, which are simply bad films, rather yeah. than, because it's, you know, it's like mean, but it's happening inside right. the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's hard to come back from, but it reminds me of like, you know, there's, you know, this has happened at other times. There's a great Ursula Le Guin quote about her reaction to seeing A New Hope in cinemas, which is that she loved it until the end when everyone joined the army.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, and that was like, oh, I'd never seen it. Like, or I had only ever approached it with this mind of someone who was just like, the rebels are amazing. And
yeah.
no one wants anything more than to join up, put on an orange jumpsuit, get in an X-Wing and yeah. fly off. That is the ultimate fantasy. Like, I daydream about that. That is where I want to be. And then, but there's no denying that that was a really compelling point. And so
yeah.
it's sort of, that's something I've always thought about when telling stories in the universe or even just my friends, right? Like, kind of want to
yeah.
ask those kinds of questions. And so the fact that Solo doesn't ask those kinds of questions, even while furnishing such a kind of lavish, comforting, you know, nest full of enjoyable...
There's nothing more comfy than falling asleep on a Wookiee's lap.
That's exactly this movie.
Yeah.
Exactly this movie. It's yeah. That is a differently charged experience for each of us.
Yeah. Depends on the Wookiee.
But yes, that's, I think, where I end with it, I think.
Yeah. That's a really nice... I think that you captured like a lot of this experience, which seems like a lot to say for a small film, but again, that's the experience of it, is that you're balancing these two, like, a lot of different scales of experience in one film. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, obviously, my relationship's a little different in that it's like similarly central in that I was obsessed with the films, but you were always like my ambassador to the extended universe. Like, I would play like little bits of the games and I would watch something and I read like a couple of the novels and I read a couple of comic books. But generally speaking, you always obviously were like way more in it and like knew more about it. So it was like, I could like ask you about that stuff because I didn't really know it as much. My experience was like really, really, really anchored on the movies, but otherwise it's a similar thing of dancing around your relationship to this thing that just takes up so much space in your imagination, and I think more importantly, like everyone's imagination, because the way that cinema works was profoundly changed by Star Wars,
yeah,
and that's why it's a different experience to watch it change itself, and so yeah, no, I think we have successfully talked about a film that, which, considering we thought we would talk for less time and also that it would be slight, it's, you know, it's some surprise we had so much to say about it. But I may try and see it again before it goes. It's definitely a thumbs up. But it's also with a kind of note of like curiosity about what happens to this big thing we care about.
Yeah. Agreed. Cool.
Shall we go fall asleep on some Wookiees?
Indeed, let's do it. Thank you for listening to our 2 hour plus discussion. Honest to God,
there's nothing more niche than this. And if you're listening to this, thank you. You're a very kind soul.
Indeed. This is almost the same length as the movie Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Yeah, we could have just started. We could have just described the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you for listening to this
non-director's
commentary of the movie Solo, A Star Wars Story. Who knows, we might try and do some more movie chats. Maybe not just about Star Wars, that'd be good.
Yeah, but we've seen other movies.
Yeah, we do see other movies.
Sometimes we chat about them.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So, but yes, thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. And we will catch you next time we do something like this.
Stay cool, guys. I am
good
not
job.
Lando.
Good job.
I'm really not Lando, am I?
as Lando famously says, stay cool, guys.
It's real hot. Yeah, that's where I'm going to finish it, I think. Bye.
Bye.